go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And welcome to this Thursday night edition, Thursday afternoon, Thursday evening, Friday morning, some Lord knows what it is on Planet Zorp edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid, tickled to death to be along with you. We've had great shows this week, I think. Wonderful conversations all three nights, even if Tuesday was somewhat foreshortened. It's been really, really enjoyable. I hope we can continue the trend this evening. With any luck, we will. I don't often theme a show. I prefer the free-form style. I prefer to let nature take its course, as it will, and see where you like to want to start the program. I'm doing something a little different this time. We're theming. Because it seems like there's more than a little bit of evidence to support the theme that I have chosen. Tonight's theme, and feel free to divert from it if you so wish, tonight's theme, beauty is only skin deep, but stupid goes clean to the bone. There's tonight's theme. Beauty is only skin deep, but stupid goes clean to the bone. And I want to introduce this concept. Yeah, you've heard it before, of course, if you're a long-time listener to this program. Oh, and by the way, just a little shout-out to Beacon Hill Joe over on the green960.com blog. The Beacon Hill Joe was responding to the whole the liberal radio holes in the format kind of the discussion going on over there at that San Francisco radio station that does excellent work, I'm told. And kindly suggested that they ought to be listening to me. And you know what? That warms the cockles of my heart. It really does. Those sorts of little kindnesses are just charming. So Beacon Hill Joe, thank you very kindly. And chime in anytime. You know how it works around here. Anyway, to go back to our overall theme, we have to do a little bit of time travel. So bear with me. I want to take you back to July the 9th. Of 2008, and we covered it at the time. July the 9th of 2008, something you've never listened to and no one in their right mind does, the G. Gordon Liddy program. Work with me here. I have my reasons. This is the G. Gordon Liddy program in which he inveighed against Barack, then candidate Barack Obama, for suggesting the audacious and insane premise that Americans might do well to learn a second language. You'll see where I'm going. Remember this? This is a real blast from the past. You can't beat G. Gordon Liddy for just plain old crazy. Here we go.
Barack Obama. He says that the Europeans coming over here and speak German and French. Well, yes, if you're from Germany, I would suspect you would speak German. And you would speak French. And they do study English because English is the universal language. All aircraft communications and all the rest all over the world are in English. No, they're not in Russian or Chinese or anything else.
But just imagine that. All those MiGs flying all over the sky during the Cold War, they were all speaking English, according to G. Gordon Liddy. you know, you, like I said, beauty's only skin deep, and it's not even skin deep on G. Gordon Liddy, but stupid does go all the way to the bone.
Think about that. He wants you to be sure that your child can speak fluent illegal alien. Sadly, with every legal and cultural step we take to make our life more immediately convenient for non-English-speaking illegal aliens, we merely feed the beast. You've just heard Barack Obama insisting that we all teach our children Spanish. Well, not mine. No way. Around here, let's see.
Yeah, around the Liddy household, they speak lizard person or pod person. I don't know.
I speak some French, some German, as well as English. Franklin speaks fluent French, fluent Italian, as well as English. But none of us here, so far as I know, speak illegal alien.
There you go. Spanish is illegal alien. I offer you that for a reason. And, Lord, how I wish I had the audio of this. I don't. But Rick Santorum is out on the speaking trail. Yes, Rick Santorum, out of work, right-wing nut job, is out talking to America. No, really. Yesterday, or day before yesterday, actually. Day before yesterday, the 17th, which was Tuesday. Rick Santorum, the former nut job senator, right-winger freak from Pennsylvania, was on the lecture circuit in Lincoln, Nebraska, at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, which I guess is the home campus, isn't it? I mean, that's where they've got that big stadium where all those people in polyester come together and you can't smoke because the whole thing would go up in a blade, just a, like flash paper. That red polyester. But anyway, he was not a Nebraska fan. Sorry, guys. Not a Big 12 fan. But never mind. Oh, dear, my ADD's kicking in. But anyway. He's a self-appointed expert on the Muslim world, Rick Santorum is. You know how it is with these right-wingers. They all appoint themselves some sort of expert. Rick Santorum, the guy who brought his little dead baby home and terrified his children with it, remember? Rick Man-on-Dog Sex Santorum has decided he is an expert on Islam. I don't know if somebody brought him some falafel or hummus or something. I've had some of that Islam food. Now I are an expert. I mean, honest to God, if Rick Santorum was a pissant, no. He is a pissant. Sorry. If Rick Santorum's brains was gas, he wouldn't have enough to fill up a pissant's motorcycle and run it halfway around a BB. There we go. That's the one. No, so somebody paid Rick Santorum perfectly good federal green to come out to the University of Nebraska Lincoln and deliver a lecture on Islam to the to the knowledge-starved corn shuckers, Huskers. Sorry, in Winston Groom's Forrest Gump, they are corn shuckers, and that's just stuck with me ever since. And Santorum, the gravamen, if you will, of Santorum's argument is that the American public knows far too little about the Islamic faith. So, among other things, he asked the poor little students there, God, it's hard to imagine this is the same university that gave us Willa Cather. It just is. And other great knowledgeable individuals. But then again, remember, we've got a there's a liberal bias in American colleges. We've got to get more brilliant conservative thinkers onto the lecture circuits there. So there's Santorum's argument that America knows too little about Islam. And to prove his point, he asked anybody if they knew the difference between Sunnis and Shias. Most of you do, because, you know, you're paying attention to your world. And only three members in the audience raised their hands. Now, the reportage that I have doesn't suggest that they were given an opportunity to explain to Rick Santorum the difference between Sunnis and Shias, because, frankly, I suspect that Rick Santorum doesn't know the difference between Sunnis and Shias. It's just like Presbyterians and Lutherans to him, you see. But anyway, this delightful quote from the Daily Nebraskan, the newspaper, the campus paper out there. Santorum said he believes Muslims' religious views cannot be changed or altered, so Middle Easterners reject American democratic ideals. Wow, that just makes the insides of my head rattle like marbles in a washing machine. Because, you know, there's nobody of Middle Eastern extraction living in the United States who have embraced democratic ideals. You know, that, or anybody who's, for that matter, embraced Islam. Because, you know, there is that little thing. Islam is not, it's a religion, it's not a geography, but, you know, don't expect a man named after an excreta fluid. Or who has an excreta fluid named after him, namely Santorum. Look it up, I ain't reading it on the air. You can't expect him to know that sort of thing. So you're wondering by this point, you know, Bob, why did you bring up the whole thing with G. Gordon Liddy and none of my family speaks illegal alien? Well, this is why. Quotes via the Daily Nebraskan from Rick Santorum. His mouth to God's ear. Really, he thinks that. He's religiously insane. Quote. A democracy could not exist because Muhammad already made the perfect law. Huh? Never mind. No, that's not. No. Quote. The Quran is perfect just the way it is. That's why it is only written in. Oh, Jesus. Drum roll, please. Islamic. No, really. This is one of those pig-licking greats. This is Ronald Reagan declaring ketchup a vegetable. This is Dan Quayle saying he was going to Latin America and wished he'd studied more Latin when he was a kid. The Quran is perfect just the way it is. That's why it is only written in Islamic. You know, when I was a little boy, sitting at my mother's knee, trying to get all literate, she taught me perfect fluent Baptist. Jesus. It's written in Islamic. Not Arabic. No. It's written in Islamic. Hey, Abdul, what language did you grow up speaking? Islamic. Not Arabic? No. Rick Santorum's in on the inside of this. He really knows the culture. And then this jewel. I think that if every citizen was fully informed about the war, it would create a commonality between faiths. You know, I don't think I want a commonality among the faiths, if that's the commonality that Rick Santorum is working toward. Where people in Saudi Arabia, or maybe the occupied Palestinian territories, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Yemen, more or less Egypt, running around speaking Islamic. Maybe this would have been better fodder for prayer meeting, but that day has passed. But just because we're outside the cathedral of common sense doesn't mean that we left our common sense in the cathedral now, does it? A democracy could not exist because Muhammad already made the perfect law. This fool doesn't understand a blessed thing about Islam. The Quran is perfect just the way it is. That's why it is only written in Islamic. He's kind of merging two concepts together there and one piece of idiocy. One little puddle of Santorum, if you will. I have read, and depending on which sect you're dealing with, you'll have one degree, a higher or lesser degree of this, that Islamic scholars, you know, scholars of the religion that is Islam, as opposed to, say, an Arabic linguist, you know, like we fired from the United States military for having a bad case of the gay, right, at the insistence of people like Rick Santorum, there is a scholarly thread inside Islam that says that the Quran, from its inception to the present, has never changed. Being an Arabic illiterate, I can't testify one way or the other to that. But I think that's what he was getting at. The Quran is perfect just the way it is. That's why it's... But obviously, Rick Santorum has never read one of those little tract guys that you've seen on top of the urinal in a rest area restroom from Chick Publications and Jack Chick that asserts the primacy and superiority of the King James Version of the Holy Bible. And they go through all sorts of twisted... pseudo-theological gymnastics to prove that even though it didn't exist until the time of King James, the King James Bible was a revealed Bible from back when Adam and Eve spoke English, Elizabethan English, and that it is perfect in every way. You can hear literalists and fundamentalists all across America on any given Sunday hollering at the top of their lungs and hacking away, you know, The Holy Bible does not contradict itself, brethren and sistren. There is not a single contradiction inside the Bible. Only the devil makes you think there are contradictions. Even when you lay the Gospels side by side and they can't even agree on Jesus' life. But every fundamentalist religion makes that argument that their sacred text is perfect. Fully rounded, a completed work, seal of the prophets at the end. That's why Revelation's at the end of the New Testament, and it's got that thing at the end, and curses and damnation be on any who would add to or take away these my words, amen, sweet Jesus, hallelujah. That's why Muhammad is referred to as the seal of the prophets. Ain't nobody going to come after and contradict him, because this is it. If I understand correctly, the Sikhs recognize their holy book as the 10th guru. The holy book is actually a prophet in and of itself. If I understand correctly, I could be wrong and more than willing to be enlightened on this. The Mormons declare that, no, Joseph Smith is the seal of the prophets. So really, it's kind of a crapshoot which seal of the prophets you buy into. Then, of course, there's the Pope at Rome, whose every word is infallible when spoken ex cathedra, you know, in his official capacity as head of the church. You know, when he officially says that all of Africa will go to hell if people there are men there are enabled to use little latex things on their willies to keep from spreading AIDS, poof, all of Africa just gone. That's all the same brand of nuttery. But damn, Even the wackiest of Christian fundamentalists doesn't run around arguing that the Holy Bible, the King James Version, was written in Protestant or written in Christian. No, that takes an especial level of stupid that runs clean to the bone in the form of mercifully former Pennsylvania senator little kids bawling on the stage the night that he got his ass handed to him, Rick Santorum. The Quran is perfect just the way it is. That's why it's only written in Islamic. And as far as I can tell, when he goes out on the hustings, Rick Santorum speaks only in fundamentalist Christian. Just astonishing. So, like I said, yeah, this coming in from Michael Kidde in the chat room. Imagine all the people killing for today. Woo-hoo! Yeah, Rick Santorum. So anyway, moving forward, we have lots more stupidity. And you will have lots of opportunity to comment on the stupidity. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877 the numeral 4, head on. That's toll free, or on your nickel, save us a little bit, 304-658-3333. If you've got some sort of unlimited long-distance dialing plan, or your carrier doesn't mind, or what have you. But that's not the end of stupid goes clean to the bone. Not by any stretch of the imagination. No. No, because when you touch, it's really not possible. Even when you've got a piece of, even when you've got a hanging curveball like Rick Santorum out over the plate and your Louisville Sluggers just right in the sweet spot, you'd smack! Back! No, you really can't talk about stupid going all the way to the bone unless you're willing to talk about look deeply into my eyes, Glenn Beck.
Brain Room downstairs, which is our fact checker, I saw something come across my desk the other day, that the average UAW worker makes Grashwell was at $154, $152 an hour when you look at what? $154 an hour if you look at, you know, if you add in all of the benefits. $154 an hour? How could you possibly be competitive?
Yeah, and it's $1,600.
Stupid. Goes all the way to the bone. Yep. Glenn Beck, there he is. Happy as a pig in poop. Right where he belongs on the Fox News channel. Claiming with not a shred of evidence, mind you, and damned little talent, that United Auto Workers, and not like the United Auto Worker who's been with GMs for, 50 years or whatever. Yeah, the guy that's climbed the wage scale as high as the collective bargaining agreement will allow him to climb it. That guy, that he makes $154 an hour. No. You heard it. He said it. The average UAW worker earns $154 an hour if you add in all the benefits. He's only off by $101. Now, in a world where we talk about billions and trillions, where millions seem blasé, to talk about $100 is passé. But when you're talking about people's lives and making right-wing war on their lives, $100 means a lot, and $101 means more. Basic addition, right? The average UAW worker earns $154 an hour if you look at, if you add in all of the benefits. Barclays Capital Analysis did a capital analysis of UAW workers, U.S. automakers. The average wage, average again, you know, arithmetic mean, that kind of thing. I'm sure there's a subtle difference there, but you get it. It's $55 an hour. Okay, so maybe it's $99. See how good I am with math? Can't do this stuff on the fly. $55 an hour is the average. But for the brain dead that watch his little sort of psychotic funhouse, they're all sitting there shaking their little bobbleheads. Madge, I'm telling you, those union auto workers are killing America. Now, this $55 an hour number is pretty well accepted. The Washington Post has relied on it. The Wall Street Journal, for God's sakes, has relied on it. And that's an average. You know, for everything above it, there's something below it. It's an average. But it's Fox. And stupid goes clean to the bone. Stupid is in their fiber optics. Stupid is in their computer chips. Stupid is in their memory. Stupid is in it's in their video processors. It's like static electricity at Fox. There's just a buzz. You pull open the little door and you go into the broadcast studio it's like that photo of Yahoo Sirius from a few years back with his hair standing on end. It is hair-raising stupidity on the right wing. And it goes on and on and on. We got lots of stupid running clean to the bone tonight. Maybe it's best we just clear the decks of it. But for now, and you are welcome to join in as well, for now we go to the phones. Susan is with us from Columbia City, Oregon. Hey, Susan.
Hi there.
How are you?
I would say, I'm hanging in there. I would say more than stupidity, although, yeah, that's there. Below the stupidity is rank, foul-smelling fear.
Yeah, right. Terror.
The kind, yeah, absolute terror. In Santorum's case, it's the panic terror that he got when he saw those towers come down, and he never got over it. He's still seeing those towers come down.
But
Maybe,
obviously you've had to sort of wander around inside the right-wing mindset to get that, Susan. And so you have the thanks of a grateful audience. And I can't, wow.
But also,
I mean, is this just A plus B equals 9/11? The square root of 9/11 equals 9/11. Everything is
Okay, in Santorum's case, because it's very obvious, because, you know, the religious, you know, it's Islam, you know, very obvious, you know, it's, you know, he never bothers to look beyond the fact that there were Muslims on board those planes that went down who died, and in those towers who died as innocents.
Right. Who spoke Islamic, apparently.
See that. He just focuses on those people who put those planes into the towers. And he just focuses on the fact that he's scared. Now, in Beck's case, it's different. Because in Beck's case, I think the fear is different. I think there's a different fear. It's called employee-free choice.
Oh, all of right-wing, and I'm sure Santorum has that fear as well, Susan. All of right-wing America lives in absolute terror of the day when America can organize, because then they're done. It's over for them.
Yeah, because let's face it, what is that going to do when the Free Choice Act passes and we go in and unionize his operation? Duh.
Oh, Lord, a unionized Fox? I don't know. This is our first obligatory Star Trek reference of the night. That's matter and antimatter colliding. The universe ends.
Well,
I'm assuming that Fox is not in any way organized.
Well, I sincerely doubt it. Any more than the company I used to work for was unionized, and we knew it never would be. They would cheerfully close the doors of the building and shut her down and move outside of the country.
But, well,
these guys are terrified. If it's not one thing, it's another, or it's a combination.
Or wait, Susan. Are they personally terrified, or is this really a con? Because it's awfully easy for me, at least, to make that leap to say it's not their own terror. It is the terror of an empowered American people. Studies have proven that Fox viewers are not the sharpest knives in the drawer, if you get the drift. That they've got to keep them whipped into a high dudgeon. We're talking about a concept that a friend of mine once referred to as cannon fodder in the culture wars.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's gay's going to get your marriage, or them union members are going to tear apart America, or
they're going to take your guns away. They're going to take your Bibles away. Ad nauseum.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always the fear card. And it's at this point, right after 9/11, the whole country fell for it. The further out we got, the more people woke up. The more people said, hey, wait a minute. Now, we're at the point where only the knuckle draggers are buying into it. And now these people who have been pushing this button are getting desperate. They're pounding that fear, they're pounding that panic button, and they're not getting any reaction. And they're panicking.
I would tend to agree with you, Susan, but I don't know if you were listening to Congressman Frank Pallone's discussion with Mark Levin a little bit ago in the last hour, when he said we can't sell universal single-payer health care because people are afraid of it.
No.
Because, and the reason I point that out is this is institutional. You know, if you say single-payer health care, Mark had a commenter who pointed out very rightly that we ought to be talking about Medicare for all. You know, it's a framing issue.
Yeah, exactly. What they're saying is we can't sell the boogeyman we have built up, but we can sell Medicare for all. It's the same.
Right, but Congressman Pallone was offering the insight that no matter what you call it, the well is already so thoroughly toxified that the American people are not ready to bite on it. That they've been told it's socialism, communism, that it's going to dig up your sainted mother's grave, whatever.
Right.
And that's why we can't have it.
You can see that in the, they're trying to take away the doctors, decisions and all this, the right wing is already starting in on that. But the thing is, that may have worked with the Clinton administration. But with the economy heading into a depression and more and more and more people with no job, no money, no way to pay for health care. Okay, there's your key.
Well, what was the number we had last night? 14,000 people a day, a week?
Something like that. Some ridiculous policy.
Losing their health care.
Yeah.
I mean, just
I don't know how to image this, Susan. Just because you don't see the stuff crumbling before your eyes, well, it's like I used to say, they don't put up a neon sign that says Empire Closed.
Yeah, and just because they don't, I have been saying for quite a while, this country is teetering. Now, it can go one of two ways. It can go the way England went and the way Canada went. And you'll notice when they put in, and the way Germany went, and you'll notice when they put in their health care for all, it was right after the war. Period of social unrest. Right?
Yeah.
People were out of work. They had to do something, which meant there was this huge pressure. It was a way to vent the pressure, because if they didn't vent the pressure, then you got the other result, which is an armed uprising. And with this country's fascination with guns, we better not hold the pressure valve closed too long. We are running a risk. FDR didn't do this, do what he did with the New Deal out of the goodness out of his heart. He did it because he knew if he didn't vent the pressure, he would be without anything at all. All of his riches would be into the hopper. We went along real good until Ronnie Reagan got in.
It really was. It was the beginning of the nightmare. And I know there are people in the audience who are older than I, and people who are younger. But I have a special animus for Ronald Reagan.
Oh, you and me both.
In my case, because that's what I had to deal with the beginning of my youth, or my adulthood. The end of my youth and my adulthood was the end of Carter and the beginning of the right-wing nightmare.
Yeah.
You're a little bit older than I, so you have perhaps, you know, you were cognizant and coherent during the Kennedy administration, for instance. You have known better days.
Yeah. I'm old enough to remember both of the Kennedys, who I loved to pieces. I remember Dr. King.
So you have a vision with which to work as we contemplate the Obama presidency, is my point.
I remember what happens when the pressure valve gets stuck.
Yeah, in the...
Remember the Watts riots? Honey, it's not pretty. It's ugly.
Right, and we don't want to go there. But you know, the right wing wants to destroy this country, Susan. And frankly, if they had that opportunity, they would welcome it, and they would cry for an absolute jackbooted clampdown on all of America.
Well, I suggest before they get too eager for that, they should read some history books, paying particular attention to two dates, 1917 and 1789. And they should remember what the French found out. Madame Guillotine never sleeps when she is unleashed.
That's scary and creepy, Susan. It really is.
And it's true. And history tends to repeat itself.
As George Santayana said, for those who do not learn it. Indeed, yeah. Indeed. Susan, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and have yourself a wonderful evening. I'm glad to have heard from you more recently now. You know, we worry.
Yeah, I know. One other thing.
Yes.
Barack Obama needs to pick up a history book, too, because he needs to start reading about the Hindu Kush.
You know, I would just recommend a very enjoyable evening with John Huston's The Man Who Would Be King. That's a nice little primer. It's not factual, but there's enough there to make you curious.
Yeah, just or just read your average high school. On second thought, you don't want to read today's high school textbook because they all come out of Texas.
I'm trying to think of the authors who referenced the history of Alexander the Great. Any of those are great in translation. And then, of course, the late great Mary Raynaud makes Alexander absolutely come to life off the pages of the books. I gave those to Agnes last year, and she just went wild over them.
Yeah, read about what happened to Alexander in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Barack Obama, if Alexander the Great couldn't take and hold Afghanistan, we sure certainly can. And I have one other point.
Yes.
We just got kicked out of an air base in one of those Stan countries in favor of the Russians. How long do you think it is before the Russians start supplying the Taliban with shoulder-mounted missiles?
How long indeed?
Sitting back and giggling?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like we didn't write the book on that.
Yes.
It's a fair inquiry, Susan.
Pay attention. History repeats.
Take care, dear.
You love to, Agnes.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's News Ninja Susan calling from Columbia City, Oregon. Mark Levine is on the line. Hey, Mark.
Hello. I actually have a slight correction for you.
What have I done wrong now?
Well, no. When you were talking about the UAW salaries, I think Glenn Beck was more than $101 off, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I went to get proof because I want to make sure I had this right. I went to the UAW website where they say that in 2006, and it's probably less today given the recession, the typical UAW represented assembler at GM earned $27.81 per hour of straight time labor, and the skilled trade worker earned $32.32. The reason why you hear 55, which is $101 less than Glenn Beck, but still really higher than what they get, is some of its benefits, but a lot of it is benefits to people who are retirees, who no longer work for the company.
Right, because they're still cheating the numbers, or the right wing is. They're counting retirees.
Exactly. So I want to let you know that even 55 is too high, because they're mixing in people who've worked for 30, 40 years, earned their retirement, gotten their pension, and that's part of their pension. That's not going to current UAW workers. So I just wanted to say that even 55 is too high. Just that minor correction, that's all.
And you know what? It's needed because it's crazy enough to have Glenn Beck. This guy opens his mouth and speaks Jabberwocky every day.
Maybe he's speaking Islamic, Bob.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. I don't speak Islamic. I didn't even know it was a language. So, you know, who knows?
You know, for all I know, he's speaking Minoan Linear A.
And anyway, that was all. I didn't mean to make a big thing of it. I just wanted to give you that.
No. That's important and it's valid, Mark, because this is what we're up against. This is what you, me, everybody on the horn is up against. Everybody in liberal talk, this little world that we're trying to hang on to is up against is this machine that's out there, because Glenn Beck says it, then Hannity repeats it, and then it goes through the next 24 hours of right-wing blather cycle.
Right, then Ann Coulter doubles it and calls to behead their leaders.
Yes, and convert them to Christianity. God.
But the thing is that even 55 is really not the right number. It is true that a number similar to that is true if you take all the retirees and divide them by the current workers, which is just ridiculous. Why would you do that? That's the wrong number of people. That's like saying if you take the number of Americans and divide them by the world population, then every American is it makes a dollar a year. Well, why would you divide them by the world population? Why would you take current workers and divide them by retirees?
Oh, my God, this is more of that dismal science, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, the current worker's salary is about $30. That's what it is. You know, it's better than the non-union people who make about 26. Not that much. The other thing that's on this website that's interesting is the entire labor cost of an average $28,000 car is $2,400. So in other words, it's less than 10%. It's less than 10% of the car. You could probably do better just negotiating at the dealer. It's 8.4% of the average price of an average GM car.
You know, have you ever bought a car new off the lot, Mark?
And I've negotiated it too.
No, I don't ever want to go to a car lot with you. No.
It's gotta be a very good price.
I'm sure you did. But I used to read, I was real geeky once upon a time. I'm still real geeky. But I used to read things like Consumer Reports, how to negotiate a car price. And it was, you know, you start with your offering number was 12%, was whatever the sticker was, less 12%. And then you haggled from there. So what you're telling me is, in essence,
it's within the haggle price.
It's within the haggle price, but the markup on the car is sufficient to eat the labor cost?
Yes, the entire labor cost.
Then how are
the markup on the car?
Okay, so I'm getting madder by the minute, Mark, at the management of the auto companies. I ain't mad at the workers. I mean, we got a little Ford dealership down here. My grandfather sold cars for them. Okay. And it's mostly all, this is West Virginia, so it's mostly all pickup trucks. And bear in mind that Ford is not part of the auto bailout, yada, yada, yada. But I went and looked at this beautiful red, you know, even to a 46-year-old little boy like me, a red pickup truck is really just eye-catching and appealing, and it just is.
It's like the little red wagon that you pulled around when you were six.
Well,
just
yeah.
A little bit bigger.
Right, and me being lefty, I'm all attracted to red anyway. And all, yeah. But anyway, beautiful red pickup truck, four doors, long bed, gorgeous bells, whistles, dual exhaust, chrome, you know, the chrome-plated cup holders, whatever. And you look at the sticker price, and it says $43,000. And my eyes bug open, and my mouth hangs down, and it's a gorgeous truck. But $43,000, I mean, who in America, in the best of times, Mark, you econ major, you?
No one would pay $43,000 for a pickup truck, no.
But they do, and they did. And what I want to know is how. I mean, I'm good enough with math that I can do the old figure $20 a month for every $1,000 finance thing, and that's an unbearable car payment.
It is. And I just remember, by the way, for anyone who is negotiating, not that anyone's buying cars these days, but I didn't do any 12% whatever. I just did the old-fashioned free market, play one off the other. When I bought a car, I call the five different places. It takes some time. You visit each of them. You get the lowest price from dealer A, and you go to dealer B, and they say, I couldn't possibly give you that price. I say, okay, well, dealer A offered it to me, and suddenly dealer B is matching and giving a bit less. They say, but you got to buy it right now. And I said, well, it depends on what you offer me. Then they give less, and I say, thank you. I don't buy it right now, and I go to dealer C. And I say, dealer B's price. It's really not that hard.
No, it's the kind of thing that you'd kind of like for the government to be involved in doing, like they do with the VA, and the Bush administration said we couldn't do with the Medicare prescription drug. No, no haggling.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so frustrating.
But the point is that it's less than 10% of a car's cost. It is literally within the margin of haggling. And so in other words, if you were to cut UAW salaries in half, take these people's livelihoods and cut it in half, you'd save about $1,000 per average car.
Then
and
where
people are desperate now. I mean, you've taken basically, you know, a two-wage earner family and made it into a one-wage earner family.
Then where in heaven's name, Mark, is the cost of the car?
Well, there's production and there's advertising and there's the metal and.
Oh, is this like Viagra's really expensive because not because of how expensive Viagra is to produce, but because of how expensive it is to advertise?
Well, there's advertisement, there's the dealers, there's, then, you know, what can I tell you? And there is the legacy cost, which you know, they do exist. People did work for 30, 40 years, they signed.
Okay, so that 10% you're talking about is not part of the legacy cost. I mean, you're not including the legacy.
No, 10% includes the legacy cost. No, well, hold on, let me look right here. This is from the website, the total labor cost. It says the total labor cost, I'm just reading directly from the UAW website, of a new vehicle produced in the United States, about $2,400, which includes direct, indirect, and salaried labor for engine sampling and assembly at the automaker's plant. I don't know whether it includes the legacy cost or not. It may not.
You know, the one thing I wish you had done, Mark, when you had Frank Pallone on, is to put to him the question of, given the problems with the auto industry, isn't this the, and I'm not trying to sound opportunist, although I suppose it is, but, you know, don't you move, I mean, you worked around Congress critters, don't you push these things when the opportunity, when the sort of symbiotic opportunity presents itself to, yeah, you strike while the iron's hot. Look at, you know, go to Detroit. Get those guys in there and say, you know, get behind universal single pay, get behind Medicare for all.
It would save the automakers a lot of money. I mean, it would. Save General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler a lot of money. It just would.
And so why?
You know, maybe not Medicare for all, Canadian health care for all. Maybe we should eke over to their system, you know?
I
don't want to be a Canadian citizen, but I do want to be part of the Canadian health care plan. Can I opt in Canada? I'll pay, you know, the half
that I pay
in America.
But this is a seriously put question. You know, Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow are the senators from Michigan.
Right. Very close.
Why are they not? I think a lot of Debbie Stabenow. Why doesn't she? Because she's got kind of that. She reminds me of those wonderful school teachers I had in the public school system growing up. Why doesn't she go?
She does have that look about her.
Why doesn't she go over and grab the ear? You know, physically grab the ear of the chairman of GM and drag him into her office and say, "This is why. You know, you want more money? Well, this is what you're going to get behind."
You're going to get behind universal health care.
Because it'll save your butt.
I don't think it's as impossible as Frank Pallone does. I agree it's impossible now, meaning right now, meaning February 19th, 2009. But I think, give us a year, I think you can build public support for this. I really do. Most Americans don't know that Canadians pay half. I mean, that should be just the commercial. Canadians pay half. Just that one.
Then Mark, let's do the other half of that equation. Canadians pay half. Do they get half?
No.
So your ad slogan is actually Canadians pay half and get more.
Right. There you go.
I mean, is there anybody in Canada with a broken leg who just, you know, went shushing down the slopes on a winter vacation, broke their leg, and they're laying, you know, they're going to lay in an emergency room until May waiting for the MRI?
That's our ad campaign, Bob. Canadians pay half and get more. Six words. Pretty simple. Bumper sticker appropriate. The kind that even Glenn Beck can understand and you know, well, I don't know about him, but most normal people. Canadians pay half and get more. I do think there is the concern among some that are very wealthy that they won't be able to get their breast implants and their liposuction.
Yeah, but what insurance pays for it? What insurance pays for it?
I don't know that any insurance pays for it. They'll still get it. I guarantee you plastic surgeons will continue to, it won't be part of our universal health care plan, but plastic surgeons I know won't go out of business.
Yeah, but see, okay, wait. Okay, now granted, this is one of those things that would drive the family values conservatives out of their crazy little minds. But for instance, okay, let's travel a little bit east across the pond to the UK health system, which also, until the conservatives got hold of it, was working quite nicely. Thank you very much, if our UK listeners are telling me straight, and I have no reason to believe they're not. Over there, procedures, for instance, and I think about this because of, you know, all the stuff I learned on Peter Godbolt's program, which was just a marvel. But over there, things like gender identity surgery are covered within the British healthcare system.
Yeah,
if I understand
I
correctly.
That
No. I wouldn't emphasize it either. But you know what?
Rights. That's not a winning argument.
It's not a winning argument, but I'm trying to make a point here. If the rich are worried that their breast implants and their Botox injections are going to go away, then let's include the rich. Let's tell them we'll do it.
Oh, that's silly, Bob.
Why?
I mean, even I can't support that. I can't support taxpayer-funded Botox injections. No, I can't. I can't do that.
For a well-heeled woman.
Well-heeled can pay for it. I'm not going to take it away from them. They just pay. They just pay for it.
I mean, I guess I look at
woman her Botox. She just has to pay for it. That's all. In addition to the universal health care she'd get.
Oh, we can cover some little part of it. This is America, for God's sakes. And I don't want to. And I don't want. And
we'll agree to disagree on.
No, but you want. No, but you know how it is with the with rich old ladies. And I'm not trying to be crude here. But you know, rich old ladies have spent years and years on the decks of yachts in the sun. They look like old baseball gloves.
Ooh, I am so not going there, Bob.
I want them to have cosmetic treatments.
Many of my listeners are women of a certain age. I will not insult.
No, but they're
them
not rich ladies. No. They're not rich ladies who spent their lives on the decks of yachts. And you're not a golfer. You've never hung out in the clubhouse.
I've seen them.
Old baseball gloves.
I've seen them.
Oh, but no, realistically, this is the transference to the logical extreme. But if you draw back a little bit, there are discussions we need to have about things like dentistry. I don't know if you've gone dental insurance. I mean, even back when I had jobs that had insurance with them, dental insurance was worthless.
I don't have dental insurance.
You paid a fortune. Well, that's because you brush and floss obsessively, Mark.
No, I brush obsessively. I'm a bad flosser.
No.
I'm now that we're in confession.
I'm telling your mother. She won't be
no.
angry. She won't be angry, Mark. She'll be very disappointed.
That's worse. Hey, I need to go.
All right. But
in that vein, how many Jewish mothers does it take to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know.
None. I'll just sit in the dark.
Oy.
Oy, exactly. Yeah, no, you don't want to have a Jewish mother disappointed at you. All right, I'm going to go. I just wanted to correct your UAW facts. You have a good show, bud.
All right, thanks, Mark. Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. It's not just Jewish mothers. Agnes works, I'm disappointed. Oh, it's like she's pulling a little red wagon. Oh, Jesus, honey, just be mad at me. Don't be disappointed, please, because it works on 46-year-old husbands, too. But really, we're talking about a doable America, and for all of their flag waving and their patriotism and all of this nonsense that the right wing does, all they ever offer us is can't. They're not just the party of no. They're the party of can't. They're the party that would have told Edison, Thomas Alva Edison, they would have said, no, we can't have that. We can't have electricity. We can't have horseless carriages. They're the party of can't. We can't have health care. We can't be a nation of laws that prosecutes crimes, no matter how high up the criminal happened to be on the political food chain or in the pecking order. We can't. I have this facility for remembering things that have happened, and I can't help remembering that during the first S-CHIP debate, we talked about a young man who died in Maryland because there was no coverage for something as simple as a filling or a tooth extraction. The young man became infected, and infections in the mouth can go systemic. Like that. And there was no coverage. But once he had become septic, he was admitted to the hospital, and I think the ultimate tab for the taxpayers was something on the order of $415,000 or $485,000, and the kid died. Talk about penny wise and pound foolish. How did we get to that demarcation, for instance, between so-called medicine and so-called dentistry? I don't know. I don't have the answer for it. Optical care. You know, Mark referenced LASIK on the air. And I guess this just proves I'm sort of, you know, some sort of wild-eyed commie. Because for those who want it and those who need it, I'm all for a healthcare system that pays for LASIK. Why not? We have proven time and again the number of things that we can pay for here. The Republican Party showed us things that they were willing to pay for that we would never have dreamed of in our wildest imagination. Bridge to nowhere. Why can't we apply our creative energies to things that actually make Americans' lives better? Hair transplants? You know, you want, hey guys, you know, you want your pals down at the bowling alley to give you a new nickname, call you plugs? Cool by me. Let's pay for it. We're America. Why not? Why not? Let's keep it rolling. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
First of all, I was going to say about the dental insurance or whatever. You either get fillings or you get...
extractions.
Cleaning or you get them all taken out, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, God forbid we should have a dental system in this country where we could pay for something like implants. You know, there are studies out there that show that people who actually have teeth as opposed to dentures live longer.
I can believe.
Whether it's their natural teeth or whether it's implants.
Well, and you know, and nothing for gum problems, which a lot of people, you know, that don't. I haven't been able to go to a dentist since... Early 1970s. I mean, I still have teeth, but all my all the fillings that I ever had have all gone out.
Dear Lord. Dear Lord.
But anyhow, another thing I wanted to say was about the Canadian health system. Years ago, in another time in the early 70s, I went to work at a hospital in the admitting department, and we had, of course, everybody had different insurance, and I had to learn, you know, the hard way by doing it because I didn't know anything about it much except what I had experienced. Anyway, there was this couple was down on vacation, and they were from Canada. And she was pregnant and supposed to be like 7 months pregnant. Well, she started going into labor, and they admitted her to our hospital, and I was the one that had to admit her, and I found out that she had Canadian insurance, or however they put it. And so we would have to get okay sometime from the other people, you know, in the insurance department. And they said, oh, that's fine. Don't worry. They'll pay everything, you know. And they had their baby there, and it was also got its little United States citizenship, too. But, boy, I'd love to see those Canadians come in because there was no problem. And, I mean, that was back in the early 70s.
And just done. No hassle. Right.
No hassle whatsoever. The people in the insurance department said, oh, that's great. I mean, they, you know, no problem. And so that's always stuck in my mind. And I think another thing, too, with the insurance that Hillary came up with at the time she came up with it, I was working full-time at a business place, and that we didn't have any kind of insurance coverage, and I couldn't afford to get it. And so I didn't have it, and I really needed something. I was having dysfunctional bleeding, and I didn't qualify to go anywhere that was free. But
too rich.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, I was at going to church then, and I think I told you about the woman that came up, and she was one of those really sweet people, and she was just angry about the health plan that the Clintons had come up with. And she said, oh, you're not going to be able to go to your room. I said, I can't go to a doctor anyway. I said, I don't have any insurance. And I said, I can't afford to pay them. And anyway, she said, well, Pat Robertson said this, Pat Robertson said that. And so I really think that they just didn't want to do anything to help Clinton out. You know, that's when even some of the Democrats, you know, some of our Republican-like Democrats were in office, and they didn't want to do anything for him either. And he had a hard time with that. And you know that what she presented them with was they weren't going to accept that carte blanche. I mean, they could have changed it if they didn't like it. They could have changed it, but they didn't want to have anything. And so that, you know, you're fighting a lot of people. You're fighting a lot of the churches and all, just like that Santora. My God, wouldn't you hate to be going to church and know that your church had paid him a ton of money?
Well, that's, and yeah, that's, I mean, that's something, and I've talked about it before, that's something I went through way back in the 80s when I found out that...
That was another thing with me, too.
Yeah, when I found out that my church had given $20,000 to Oliver North to come and tell them how to be moral.
Yeah, he was down here, too, at a church. And also, who was the, who was Bush One's, Dan Quayle?
Yeah, potato, and with, also that, potato with an E, Dan Quayle.
The one that gambles, you know, none of your business gambler.
Oh, yeah, the bingo,
holy righteous
one. Yeah, bingo Billy Bennett.
The Christian bookstore sell his book about...
Virtues, William Bennett.
Yeah. And then another thing that you were talking about was about how they talk about what the auto workers are making. And you know, that's the way a lot of them do with welfare. They say, oh, you can get like $15,000 a year on welfare. That guy that's on 2020, I guess he's still on there.
John Stossel.
Yeah.
Idiot.
He even had written a book with that. Well, that's if you qualified for everything they have to offer. That's like if you qualified to get a house or if you and they just add them all together. It's like, and I don't know anybody's getting that kind of money. I would have loved to have got that kind of money if I could have. But see, it's just so much lying going on. And I didn't particularly care about that Peroni or whatever.
Pallone.
What his response was that, you know, oh, it's just no use, you know, you're just not going to get the vote. Well, try. Why can't we try?
Because there's a few different species of political animal in Washington, D.C., especially among our elected representatives, Juanita.
Yeah.
And one of them is the political pragmatist. And they tend to be the ones who have been there the longest. And they tend to be the ones who prefer doing something as opposed to nothing and doing less as opposed to doing more. Because they say it is simply politically impossible. I hate that phrase. Well, it's politically impossible. You know, we can, and underlying that is a certain reality, Juanita. And that reality is the fact that it has been made. You know, these things are not born politically impossible. They have been made politically impossible.
Right.
If you go back and you study the nature of the American healthcare debate, this issue was, I believe, first credibly raised during the Truman administration.
Oh, yeah.
And it was carried forward, and the debate was had during the Eisenhower administration. And I have, I've got this book of editorial cartoons, and I can't remember who it was now, so because somebody corrected me on it. But I've got a book of editorial cartoons, and there are a number of them about Eisenhower constantly inveighing against the idea of covering all of America. So to the extent, and that's one of those, you know, hazy, misty fogs of time, golden age kind of stuff that I despise. You even hear people, the Democrats, liberals, so-called progressives, you hear them saying, well, you know, at least Eisenhower was a good Republican, or that Eisenhower was a Republican that could be respected. That man beat hammer and tongs, Juanita, against the idea of every American having access to health care when the rest of the world was first going in that direction. Yeah.
And you know, I'm like you. You hear, you know, people say, oh, it was so wonderful back then. Well, it was rough on
a lot of people.
It was rough down south for sure. My daddy used to call him Eisenhower.
That's beautiful. You know, yeah. I'll say this again. I think your daddy and me would have had some wonderful conversations.
Y'all would have. Yeah, you would have. He was like you. He couldn't keep his mouth shut. I don't mean that.
Oh, thanks a million, Juanita.
Well, you know, saying about my daddy, you know, it's a compliment.
Yeah. Well, and
he didn't mind. The president could have come, and he would have told him.
Yeah, but, that because he had learned hard lessons about Republicans.
Yeah. And, you know, and can I say another thing?
You can say
about.
Anything you want to, Juanita.
Well, I'm thinking about time, but my folks were always, you know, for a union, and you know they had union down here in the citrus. That's all there, basically all there was for people to get to do when I was coming up, and they were loyal workers. They were hard workers. They loved. They'd go to work early, you know. And you know, just do the very best they could. And they always supported the union. Well, we had a really lousy union, but my folks, all the way. And one time that I know they had a strike, and my dad was out there on the strike. I think my mother was, you know. And so we were kind of oddballs in our neighborhood, I think. But and they supported them, and we had what I always called a sweetheart union. You know what that is?
You mean one of those that's more or less run by the company?
Yeah. But nevertheless, they would do some good things, and they had to, and well, a lot of things that people don't understand about unions is that they fight for the non-union workers too.
Sure they do. You know,
absolutely.
There's an organization here in West Virginia that was the first sponsor of getting me on the air in Beckley, and I will forever be grateful to them, called the Affiliated Construction Trades Foundation. And their motto here in West Virginia, Juanita, is if you're working in West Virginia, we're working for you. Not if you're in a union and working
right,
in West Virginia.
Right.
If you're working in West Virginia.
Right.
Because what the ACT Foundation advocates is far and away beneficial to everybody who goes and gets who does anything that gets a paycheck.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's a marvelous little model that I've run into people in this in other states who, hearing about that organization, have just sat there in wide-eyed wonder and openly said, man, if only we had something like that here.
Yeah. And, you know, they never did get any kind of pension. My mother was trying to, and she passed away, and there was so much, you know, going on with that, that you had to fight for so much, and I was trying to work and everything, and I just, you know, had to let it go. And then later on, some of the people did get their pensions, but from them. And they had worked less time than my mother had. My mother had a lot of hours in. But nevertheless, they would have never said, you know, that they regretted, because they've supported all the way. And so, you know, I want to say one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
Suzanne for the Congress. Wow. Couldn't she tell them a thing or two?
Oh,
I
think she could. I absolutely think she could.
Yeah,
yeah. Now, you sit down and
the
listen.
The more I hear, you know, the more I think, wow, that girl. We get her and get Sandra.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
who could have it made?
Talk about a liberal caucus of two. Right.
Well, you love it.
Well, and that's, you know, you raise another issue, Juanita, and that is so-called campaign finance reform, what a lot of us in the liberal community refer to as clean elections.
Yeah.
It is possible to get people with the verve and the go-get and the smarts to get this kind of stuff done into the Congress. All we have to do is get the dirty money out.
Yeah.
Clean elections have been passed in place. Well, Maine has them. And you've got a much more activist-oriented, much more populist state house as a result. Everywhere that clean elections are enacted, you get people who are actually empowered to go and participate in what is designed to be a participatory political process in the first place. And that's you know, talk about a brain drain. The brain, you know, we have a brain drain in our political process that is enforced by virtue of the fact that only the rich can be in it.
Uh-huh.
And, being rich, no matter how much the neo-Calvinism that goes on among the right and culturally, the cultural or political right in this country, wealth does not necessarily confer brains.
Oh, Lord, no.
And I want some smart people in, I want some smart people in political offices.
In fact, they're not the only two.
I would hazard
our listeners. I mean, you know, among the people listening and calling in, we got some smart folks.
Yes, we do. And I would hazard a guess that if you actually made Congress, both houses, sit down and take an IQ test, I would bet you that the average IQ of Congress would be somewhere around low average.
Yeah, they certainly aren't well informed. Have you ever seen some of them on the journal on C-SPAN? And people would call in and
Rick,
like,
Juanita, Rick Santorum was a member of the U.S. Senate, and he's talking about people speaking Islamic.
I know. Oh, me.
That's the kind of thing that's made that if the studio was any bigger and I had a cordless mic, I'd just be running around the room screaming when I see it. You know, because I first saw that last night, and I held the laptop over to Agnes and said, look at this. And she just sat there and read it, and her eyes got bigger and bigger, and her mouth said, oh, my God, Bob. Yeah, it's stunning. The level of idiocy, and I say, well, for instance, that IQ test I was talking about in the Senate and the House of Representatives, if you made them take it, the people that would be dragging down the curve would be the Repig-Licking Party, because they're not real bright. All they really are hacks for their owners.
And they don't understand humor or anything, you know. They don't understand nuance.
not worth a nickel, they don't.
But boy, wouldn't you love to watch the Senate and the House if they were full of folks like us.
it would be at least engaging. Juanita, wonderful to hear from you this evening.
It would be like paradise.
Yeah, a little bit. You take care now.
Okay, take care of yourself.
All right, bye now.
Night-night. Bye-bye.
Calling from Central Florida, our View correspondent, that's Juanita. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, welcome to the program indeed. Here we go again.
Hey, Reverbo, what's up, brother?
I don't know, man. I just when you think that the week is sort of sliding in towards Friday and the weekend, we're all agitated again. You get everybody agitated.
Well, I'm an outside agitator.
That's exactly what you are. As a matter of fact, are there any nominations? Can we have nominations for the Stupid Goes Clean to the Bone award tonight?
I don't know. I mean, I've got more examples, but right now, how is Rick Santorum not just way out in front of the pack?
He's out there, but I got somebody who's gaining on him.
Really? On the inside, on the rail?
Yeah, he's not going to make it because Santorum is so just completely mind-bendingly, stupid that I don't think anybody can catch him. But this guy made a run at it, and I'm going to nominate matter of fact, his state is only, God, I hate to even say this, about an hour from me. I'm going to nominate the governor of the state of South Carolina.
Mark Sanford.
Sanford. For Stupid Goes Clean to the Bone. Mark Sanford, he was thinking about you know, the money that was going to go to help his state, and he just allowed that he didn't really want any of it. He just thought, no, I don't, the hell with it. I don't like this, and we're just not even going to accept any of it, he says. He said he has changed his tune. I don't know why.
Repiglick and speak with forked tongue? Is that what we're getting at?
I wish, you know, if he'd have said that, I wish somebody would have jumped on it right away and said, okay. Okay, we'll just get that money that was going to go to your state to somebody who appreciates it.
Well, that
Thank
did
very
that,
much, sir.
That did kind of happen, Reverbo. Paul Begala jumped on that like a duck on a June bug.
He did.
Yeah, he said, "Well, Governor Sanford, you're not for it. Don't take it."
You know, the thing is 1,100 pages long, something like that. The big check that Obama wrote, the bill itself is. It's just, I mean, it's just like an encyclopedia.
Oh, yeah, I saw Lindsey Graham waving it about in the Senate, and then I saw John Punkinhead, Punkinface Boner throw it to the ground in the House. Throw it to the ground, Centurion!
He threw it to the ground?
Yes.
God, these people just need a public slapping. I just can't even understand it. In all of those 1,100 pages, though, this is the way I figure it. Because, you know, let's just call it, we just call it as we have to see it, and you've seen it, and you've called it, and you know where I'm going with this. I'm sure Governor Sanford just kind of skimmed through those pages, and he didn't really see any money set aside for either liquor stores, fireworks stands, or supersized adult bookstores.
Wait, what about the roadside stand selling peaches?
Those are actually worthwhile. Maybe.
Well, okay. Okay. Well, so are the liquor stores.
What about the supersized adult bookstore? And all these three are usually under the same roof. And this is the main export.
Capitalism.
Yeah. And so it must not have been anything in there for that. They must have overlooked that. And so he said, well, no thanks.
It's the barbecue, dirty book, liquor, superstore.
I think there's another old joke that people said around here that, you know, in North Carolina you've got culture, and in South Carolina you have agriculture. Something like that.
But, you know, yeah, to be fair, it's not just Mark Sanford. You know, that goofy freak up in Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty. I there's something that just makes me feel like I'm abusing the language when I say Pawlenty. It sounds like the name of a dog food, Pawlenty. He came out with this trenchant observation, Reverbo. Just because you didn't order the pizza doesn't mean you can't have a slice.
Well, where was everybody with their notebooks and pens? Whew.
Well, that little goofball never went to college with me. Because if you didn't chip in on the damn pizza, you weren't getting a slice. I remember.
I guess, I don't know, you can quick act like basically the turd that you are and then kind of scramble back to your chair and hope no one heard you? Is that what they do?
Yeah, well, I got a nickel. You know, and then there, of course, there's Bobby Jindal in Louisiana.
Well, he's a piece of work.
Not sure if he's going to take the bailout money, which would have come, and they've already figured it out, it would be $3.8 billion to Louisiana. Bobby Jindal's not sure if he's going to take that money.
I wonder if he should make some phone calls and see if that's okay with his constituents.
Well, it's not. I can tell you for a fact because there is already the William Jefferson, the guy who had the bales of money in the freezer, who was a Democratic congressman from Louisiana, by virtue of the fact that that district has been so thoroughly ethnically cleansed in the wake of Katrina, was and the money in the freezer didn't help. Was beaten by America's first Vietnamese candidate, or not candidate, but successful Vietnamese candidate for the House. The man's last name is Cao, C-A-O.
Really?
Yeah. And he said in the weeks leading up to during the debate and the weeks leading up to the vote on the stimulus package. We got to find a better word for that, Reverbo. I'll put you in charge of that if you don't mind.
I've invented something else, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay. So in the weeks leading up to it, he says, yeah, you know, I think I'll probably vote for the package because it's needed here. Well, the minute he said that, John Boehner with his was down there just roughing him up. And lo and behold, this character, this brand new freshman congressman from Louisiana, had decided that, you know, he didn't want to vote for none of that liberal welfare for his state. Joseph Cow is the guy's name. He said, and I quote, "I believe that more likely than not, I will vote for it because the second congressional district needs a stimulus package." And then he caved. Well, guess what, Reverbo? They've mounted a recall campaign on him, the people of that said second district. Granted, it's an uphill fight. They've got to have something like 100,000 valid signatures from registered voters in the district in 180 days. That's a third of all district voters.
Can you even comprehend, though, what somebody like Boehner and these people can threaten you with anymore? Is it like the, remember in Superman comics had that character, it was the Reverso character, the backwards character, and everything like blue was red, and they're yes, not no, and, well, what did Boehner say to them? He goes, nope, we gotta make sure to stand firm on this. We're the party of death. We're the party of pain. That's how we're going to win again. We're the party of suffering.
Well, you want to know what I find most interesting out of this, Reverbo, is the people who have started this recall campaign. It's not a bunch of like liberal left wing, the commie agitators carrying like etouffee and gumbo and stuff since it's New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a group of ministers. It's a group of ministers who are going to go into their churches on Sunday and talk about this. Rightly or wrongly, under the 501c3 rules. I mean, God knows the Republicans did it.
Oh, I'll do it. I'm okay with it if it's for something I want. I'll play that.
Sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. We get to play at this, too.
There you go.
But it's a group of ministers, and they are righteously angry. You know, they're Jesus in the temple whipping the money changers mad. I love this because one of the things that Joseph Cow cited as his reason for voting against the package, it only creates 4,800 jobs in his district.
I don't understand. So he wanted more of that liberal welfare now? What is he saying?
I guess.
He wants more of what he doesn't want.
Louisiana's going to get $308 million for road work. And his district is going to get $91 million of it.
It's a big chunk.
There will be an extra $1.4 billion to more expeditiously settle FEMA claims. Disaster claims. He voted against it, Reverbo. You know, don't let this guy take root. I hope the people in that district get really earnest about this. Don't let him take root. Because once he gets past term number one, he's, you know, once you're an established incumbent, it gets statistically more difficult to remove you from the House of Representatives than it is to remove a member from the old Soviet Politburo. No
There's
kidding.
There's a place people can go to, or evidently to watch, to look where the money's going and how it's being spent, and maybe see how everybody's, you know, making out with it and stuff. And, I mean, this is just stunning to me how these the Republicans are, they are firmly establishing themselves. They've ordered a huge coffin big enough for all of them to fit inside.
Well, and it gets better. Our buddy Bart Kopp over at BartKopp.com had three GOP quotes. Okay, these are all from people who voted against the stimulus, all right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got John Micah, who voted against it. Quote, I applaud this. Now, he only says this once he gets home. I applaud President Obama's recognition that high-speed rail should be part of America's future. But he voted against it. Then there's Senator Kit Bond of Missouri. Voted against it. This is the type of emergency stimulus spending we should be supporting. Programs that will create jobs now and help families. And then there's Leonard Lance of New Jersey. Tell me that doesn't sound like some sort of a porn name.
It's excellent.
This is a classic. This is a classic example of a shovel-ready project. He voted against the shovel-ready project.
Wait a minute. This is reverse world. What are you? I'm not even following this. This is so incredible. These people are lauding it. And they're holding it up as...
Well, see, they probably had a lot of phone calls coming into their offices saying, hey, you horse's rear end, don't come home. We needed that, and you voted against it.
Man, can you imagine being in a state that embraces it and, you know, supports it and does the best you can with it, and right next door to you is some state, I don't want to mention any of the names of these states, who... still didn't get with the program. And now they're still, no, I don't think we want any help. We just want to just starve here. I mean, I don't know. You're right about the incumbency problem. That's always been a problem, but boy.
And I don't know enough about House procedure, Reverbo, to understand completely whether or not this could be done. But I'm feeling a little, and I'm ashamed. You know, because I'm all peace-loving and stuff. I'm feeling a little vindictive. And there will be a second stimulus bill. I guarantee it. And when that comes around, I want language in it that says, a no vote ensures that none of the money goes to your district. Not a dime.
By that time, I'm hoping that that's exactly what they'll do. They'll quit. They'll realize that working with the other side is an oxymoron. Just not even bother. How about this? I have an idea for the Stupid Goes Clean to the Bone Award. I was thinking about this, and maybe some of your callers can come up with a... Or some of those goofballs in the chat room, and they know who they are, can come up with maybe some alternate ones. I was thinking of like a lead statuette, right? You don't want to make it out of anything... precious, like silver or gold. It would have to be like something made of coal or lead. A lead statuette, perhaps, and the head of this thing comes to a nice little point. What do you think of that?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. And then when Mr. Santorum comes up and there's all the applause and he gets presented with the award, I'm sure he'll have a nice little speech. You know, this really, the thing that bugs me about all this, and this is the thing that really just drives me crazy about the Medicare for All and all this stuff. Good grief. This really is our country, Bob. We can make it what we want it. Can't we?
Maybe yes!
We're on the hook.
Well, yes!
We are on the hook all the time for things we don't want. Constantly, we are paying for wars, and we're paying for oil, and
we're on the hook for fighter jets that are three generations better than anything the rest of the world has and might be able to go up against the alien craft.
Well, they don't seem to be helping us much against teenage girls who strap dynamite around their boobs.
Yeah, not so much.
Not so much. But, I mean, good grief, my entire adult life, I've been paying for things I wouldn't have voted for. I mean, constantly I am in debt for things that suck. I don't understand. Why can't we just go into debt for things that are good?
We just, and to be fair, we just got on the hook for what started out as 12 and is now 17,000 more American soldiers for the next 5 years in Afghanistan.
Yeah, we have.
And that, not the soldiers, but that concept sucks. Doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't understand. If you are asking me to pay, then I don't understand. Why is it so hard to pay for something? Now, admittedly, there are some things that sounded good and they didn't work out so well, but you got to try. I mean, this is like labor unions. I mean, labor unions, we can't just paint them with a broad brush and say how wonderful they all are. Labor unions have a checkered past, as we all know. Lyndon Johnson's Great Society sounded kind of good and turned out to be a total bust, but the New Deal.
But it turned out to be a total bust because it was ruined by Republicans, Reverbo.
Yeah, it was the implementation of it. It wasn't the.
You know, TVA was a lovely idea until the profiteers got hold of it.
But at least these things are like, you want to use that word, root. At least they are rooted in some benevolence and some kindness and some, instead of rooted in thievery. I mean, these plutocrats, I don't know. Why is it so hard to pay for good things? And it's so, boy, when you got something bad on the grill, when you got something nobody wants to eat, boy, they just jam it.
Belly up!
This is the part I do not get. It's idiotic. Of course I get it. Because it is not a democracy, and it is not free here. It is not, we have no liberty. We are the Wall Street. It's what we got to do.
Wall Street does seem to be the punch bowl, doesn't it?
Well, like we were talking about once, Wall Street, if the military industrial complex really is not, that's a misnomer. It's the money complex is what it is. It's the overarching pursuit of profit over people, and it is. I think people maybe are sick of it. I don't know. This is a turning point now. We're going to have to see what happens now. We are really sitting on the edge here. And it's so funny because, again, this is driving
me. Well, we're sitting on the edge, but to haul out a pop culture reference real quick, Reverbo, we're sitting on the edge, but we're Wile E. Coyote. And you know how, whether he's standing on the solid part of the rock or the overhang part, whichever part he's standing on is the part that falls? Complete defiance of gravity, the works. That's where we're sitting, and it's those little crumbling bits of dirt that you see that presage him holding up the sign that says, "Help! It's us. It's we."
I, for one, don't think the entire economy of the United States is going to disappear. I think we are going to pull out of this, and we're probably going to pull out of this sooner than the rest of the world because we have more resources than the rest of the world, ultimately, and we got people that aren't going to let this happen.
See, that's what worries me. I'm not concerned about the people who want to make things better. It's the people who are willing to stand in the way and the people who are willing to let them stand in the way. You know, I really am. I want to see the drama in the Senate. I want to see Mitch McConnell stand up and read The Wealth of Nations or Milton Friedman's PhD dissertation or the Louisville, Kentucky phone book, something. I want to see that guy filibuster. And I want to see him hand it off to another one and another one and another one. I want to see them do it. And then when they can't do it anymore, I want to bust their butts.
Right. I want every American, every voter to memorize how to spell their names and who they are. Pick them out of the lineup, these people. It just pisses you off because they turn everything into around on its ass. I'll let you go here in a minute. But it's like this incredible debate about Medicare for all. And I just keep thinking back to like in every society, every society that gives a damn, there's people you got to carry. There's always people you have to carry for one reason or another. They can't work or they're sick or whatever it is. And we can't hate them or ostracize them. We have to help them. And they used to call them welfare queens here, remember? Ronald Reagan called them, you know, driving up in your Cadillac with your 14 kids.
Don't forget to get your food stamps.
Oh, I guess that person's a white woman now. Oh, well, never mind. But anyway, there's another joke we won't use. Let me just get rid of that one. but I mean, the social safety net, this whole socialized safety net, the thing that they rail against, God damn it, these people just giving all this stuff away to these worthless.
No good duelists won't work. Yeah, I know.
It's a great idea, though. Wait, hey, come back. How about if we give everybody this? Isn't that what we're talking about?
Well, it kind of is, but see, everybody still has a subset of those doulas, worthless people that they hate. You know, there was a discussion during Mark's show going on in the chat room about emergency care and how an emergency, you know, because one of the favorite things of the right wing is to say, well, you know, anybody who's sick can always go to the emergency room. Everybody's got health care in America. Give me another $15 cigar. And it ain't true, because an emergency room in America is only required to stabilize you. And the definition of stable, the definition of uninsured, well, the definition of uninsured is very certain. The definition of stable is very fluid. And I can cite to an example of that that is personal in nature. Last May, I wound up in a hospital with my innards rebelling against me. It was, quite frankly, sadly similar to the same sort of malady that landed John Ashcroft in the hospital a year or so before. John Ashcroft was hospitalized for 2 weeks and carefully monitored and watched like a newborn, because he had the best socialized health care this country has to offer.
That government insurance is great.
Yeah. I was, and at the time, granted, I was in my Viking gone to seed phase, Reverbo. I had hair down past my shoulders and a beard down to my Adam's apple. Because I do that sometimes. It just happens. And, but I was well-spoken. I was reasonable and rational. I was hurting like all hell. And I had an emergency room doctor who looked at me and said, "You no drink! You no drink!" And I look at him and said, "Not even water? No, alcohol! Alcohol!" I said, "That's not an issue." You know, I had triglycerides that were, you know, to the moon, which leads to this condition. Because I'm a factory for the stuff. And I hadn't been able to buy my medicine for 3 months.
But this guy
immediately gives me the boys under the bridge treatment. You know, you no drink screw top wine no more.
Well.
But what happened then, where Ashcroft, who tipples a bit, was hospitalized for 2 weeks, I was stabilized and sent home with a handful of pain pills and a cranberry juice.
Like you just went in there to give blood or something.
At least I didn't get the peanut butter and crackers. I'd probably be dead by now.
Were you, I don't know, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, Mr. Kincaid, but did you at the time have any sort of health insurance?
No.
You know what they call people who don't have health insurance in this country?
Dead!
They call them bums.
Ah, well, yeah, there you go.
I mean, that's the problem. Why can't we have this? Why can't we just fix this for everybody? We can, you know.
Yeah, we can.
We can. That's,
you know, we can look at the rich and say, hey, listen, if you're so stupid as to participate in a company that profits from your illness, go ahead. The rest of us are going to do it right. It's like Levine said, pay half, get more.
You were making a joke that he wasn't on board with paying for the Botox and paying for the Viagra and the hair replacement. But I don't think it's funny. I think we can have that too.
I wasn't joking.
I think you can have whatever you want. I mean, I don't care.
And this goes back to the stuff that you're taught when you're standing there with your hand over your heart learning to say the pledge when you're six. This is America. This is the land of we will do it. This is can-do America, built Ford tough. You know, if it needs doing, we'll do it.
Good Lord, you're on the hook already for $3 trillion for the Iraq war. What did that get us?
At this point, we're talking about pennies.
Now we might as well go for the Botox, go for the fat reduction, get surgery, go for everything. I want a shark fin growing out of the back of my goddamn neck.
Right. Yeah. I want to complete that research, that dental research where they use stem cells to grow tooth buds like a newborn in adults. I want that.
Well, one less F-18, and you can have that.
F-22.
So that's one less F-18, and everybody can have that.
Two less F-22s, and, yeah, we can even include the illegals. It was 5 years ago when Dennis Kucinich said, listen, we cut out the waste in the Pentagon, and it's paid for. And that's not with some broad definition of waste where, you know, you define waste as being having a military, you know, like the right wing says it. Oh, you just hate America. You don't want to, you hate our soldiers, you hate your troops. No, it's stupid, wasteful stuff. Eliminate that, and it's paid for.
Oh, yeah, like it's always been. They can have all the jets and subs they need. I agree with you. There's tons of money just getting the waste is just it's obnoxious. It's been going on ever since I remember. That people have been talking about this for decades. Well, when they have their hand in your pocket, it's really hard for them to not just hard for you to get that hand out.
I know.
All right. Well, anyway.
And all things being equal, I do have a couple more nominees for Stupid Goes Clean to the Bone.
Well,
and, yeah.
All right. All right, we'll tell you that. Keep it personal, my friend.
Keep it personal, Reverbo.
All right, later.
Later. That is our critic at large, Reverbo. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Hello? Anybody there? Going once? Going twice? I can hear me in the background.
Oh, hello? Sorry.
Yeah, hello?
Hey, Bob, it's Renee Louise.
Hey, Renee Louise.
I'm sorry, you had me on hold there for a while, and I got doing five things at once. I was just calling in to see if I could get an update from you on if there was any progress with our little movement.
I've gotten some emails. I'm waiting. Yeah. I'm waiting for more.
Okay, so maybe we need a refresher for everyone out there.
Sure.
Family?
Absolutely.
Have we gotten a good amount?
Not a bunch.
Not a bunch, huh? Hey, guys, Bob Kincaid is here every day for us. The head of our little family here is here every day for us, day in and day out. And he needs us. Him and our other fellow Appalachian sisters and brothers need us. They need us to fight this coal issue. They need us to sign on to a petition for them so that when Bob goes up there March 2nd and does his march and goes and visits those certain people, and also to get the NRDC and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. into this more immediately as well, he needs our voices behind them. If we can't, if our little family can't come together and do this, especially for Bob, then I don't know what's going to happen to this country of ours, because this is a perfect little microcosm of the macrocosmic problem that's going on here. So I would again just please urge everybody, and just think about it, as I've said before, these people are being slowly slaughtered while we sit here and find some other diddling thing to do besides send up a quick email to Bob saying, Bob, I am with you. Count me in. So that then Bob and the rest of the wonderful people who make the horn work can go ahead and send an email back to you so that you can click on it and sign on to the petition to support him, to support his voice in what he's trying to do for us to get this issue put to bed. So I don't know. I'm going to keep calling in, so people are probably going to get tired of me.
Wear it out.
Shut me off. But really, I think it's pathetic. If we don't come through for you, I really think this is pathetic. We're not asking for money. All we're doing is, why are you listening? Why are you listening then? All right? If you aren't right this moment, you should have emails rolling into you. It doesn't even take, at the most, it takes a minute. Bob, I'm with you.
And we've gotten some of those.
Okay.
Just not a bunch.
Well, I'm sure I don't know if you'd want to disclose even the percentage of what our family, who usually clicks on and listens in whatever capacity is, the comparison is.
Not a big percentage.
Yeah, exactly, Bob. So that's why I'm pushing it. Nothing is being, you are here day in and day out for us. listening to our frustrations, letting us come on the phone and vent longer than they could be able to get to vent anywhere else. And if we can't do this for you, I don't know. I'm speechless that it hasn't already happened. People who were sitting there when I first put out the call, the asked for their help on this, to stand with me, with you on this, every single one of us should have been on. I sent mine right away. There's no reason for it. 2 seconds. You're the only way you can listen to Bob right now is if, or when you're hearing him, is on a computer or somewhere nearby. Break away for a minute. 2 seconds. Bob, I'm with you. And I mean, here is going to show who our family really is. It's really going to show. And I'm sorry, Bob. I don't know if it hurts you, but it hurts me that people aren't standing up like for this with you. You should not be doing this alone. You're doing this not just for yourself and your and
but to be fair, I'm not doing it alone.
I know.
There are people who have lived and died doing this.
Exactly.
Who laid this groundwork far before I ever opened my mouth about it, Renee Louise, and that is the honest truth.
I understand that, and that is the framework that has been laid for us. But as I said before, the problem with us, as whatever you want to call us, liberals, progressives, with the perspective that we have, the problem is that there is a framework out there. There's all these little fragments out there, and we are dropping stitches. We need to, especially now with everything that we're about to face, we need to stand up and take responsibility, take back the control of our government, which we relinquished. We're the ones, whether you did or not, put that the people who are in office these past 28, 30 years, we all are in some way, in some degree, responsible for it. Because we've allowed it in one way or another to continue. We weren't out in the streets enough. We weren't banging on the doors loud enough. We weren't reaching out enough. We weren't knitting the stitches together tightly enough. And the preamble of our Constitution says, we the people, da-da-da-da-da-da, do ordain and establish this Constitution. So the buck lies with us. We have to hold the people we put in there accountable. And if we have to recall every single one of them to get their butts out of there.
Well, two more just rolled in, Renee Louise. One saying, Bob, some of those listening are actually working. Post a link to the petition. I'm on it. And now back to work.
Mental note. Okay, then I'm going to also put a plea out there. I mentioned this to you before, and I hope you don't mind me. You can stop me if you say. But I would also like to put a plea out there to Mark and to John and to Guy, whenever they are on the air, and even to Ben, maybe he can put something on the front end or the back end of the archives of the podcast, putting out the plea for this, for people to join us in this movement. Because it's so immediate. It needs to be acted on now. Your meeting on Friday showed how immediate, how urgent this needs to be addressed. How urgently this needs to be addressed. And minute by minute, it's a slow slaughter that's going on, a slow slaughter of our mountains, a slow slaughter of our brothers and sisters.
Yeah, the people who live among them.
Yes. Yeah. And I know you've had other people working with you, but that's separate from who I'm talking about. You are not to be, when I say you shouldn't be doing this alone, Bob, I mean those other people who are already doing it with you. Coal River Mountain. Yes, BNR, there's so much, I can't even, you far more know everybody involved than I do, and I apologize that I don't know everybody's name to list it down. But I do also know that BNRDC and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have been involved in this, but they need to be involved in it more immediately now, too. So if we can put our voices behind you, as I've said before, as you have said as well, they are, and as Susan just said, they are scared of us when we get our numbers together. We have the power if we will just step up.
You can measure the terror of the other side. No, wrong word. You can measure the gut-bending fear of the other side in the escalating hatred of their remarks. Some of that stuff that I read last night from that simple story on one of the local TV websites about Ashley Judd stepping up and coming out against mountain removal in Kentucky. And your husband ain't even a good race driver. He ain't even good as Dale Jr. and Don Blankenship running around at this point, squealing so hard that he's up on his tippy toes, hollering Greeniac and socialism and communist state, you know, if we have viable mass transit. They are water bowel scared.
Of course, and that's why they're being so vehement. That's why they're so nasty. That's why. Because they know they're being strangled. They know that we are ready. We're at the point of ready to. We could do it right this minute. We could just boom, knock out the whole thing if we just stand firmly together. And I also realize the position that so many people are in. I'm on the hamster wheel of survival too. But you know what? If we don't jump off now and hit the ground running, that hamster wheel is going to take us all down. It doesn't matter. And who cares? The ones who are in power don't care if we go. When we go, there's others right behind us. We've bred more to follow us. And they'll just keep churning us up on that hamster wheel of survival. And if we don't stop and say no more, and we can do it now before we have to have an all-out revolution to finally get it back. You know, and then of course we have Directive 51 still hanging over our heads. That puts, you know, other ways to. Sandra said it perfectly too. I felt as well. You know, this military. I'm getting off track anyway. But this military complex we have built here, whichever way they have to point it out to keep us in fear, it'll take. And we've just got to stop. If we stand up together, we are unstoppable. And right now, we have a perfect opportunity, this Horn family right here, and it's inexcusable if we don't stand up and do something about it. Get up and stand up behind you right now. And if only two emails come in, that's, you know.
Well, but it's even as you have been speaking, it's been growing.
More emails
rolling in, and people even popping into the headonradionetwork.com chat room to respond to your call.
Well, thank you, because this means everybody who's responding, thank you. I just hope you know how heartfelt this is, because it's about all, you know, we are all one. Whether anybody completely can grasp it or not, at least I can pass on how I see it. Each one of us is a piece of the other. Even if you want to break, I break it all the way down to energy. Energy is the one element that can neither be created nor destroyed in this whole reality that we are aware of. We are all made up of that same energy. And if we just come together, we are going to have such power. And we are going to have, instead of just talking about the world and the life that we envision, we can have it. We will have.
And everything you say applies to so many, not just to the immediate topic, Renee Louise, but
right.
to think, you know, we've been talking a lot about healthcare this evening.
It talks to everything that we are facing right now, and that's why I am, like, I'm screaming at the top of my, and the reason why I've picked the Horn to go ahead and voice and express what's going on inside of me as well is because of the humanity that I have seen in the people who are involved in the Horn. Because I see the Horn as having the greatest potential for and greatest force for really standing up and being an example for the rest of those, our brothers and sisters out there in this world with us. Because it's a world thing, too, that's got to be turned.
Yes, it is. I mean, and that was the whole motivating vision behind what created all this.
Well, the Horn reaches out, I know. But even more, it's the humanity that I have seen in the people involved in the Horn, whether it's those of you working behind the scenes, like keeping it up every day, keeping it going all the time, or whether it's the people who call in, or whether it's just the listeners. You know, I even call us listeners because it is a family. The humanity that I just can feel coming through when we all come together. Even through podcasts, when you come together and you sit down to spend that time with Bob, but it's actually you're spending it with so many others who we have never even seen yet before, and maybe we won't ever get to see. Gosh, I wish we could. But even if we didn't, we're connected. And we come together with Bob every moment that he's there for us. We come together because of that humanity, because of the understanding. And if we can't stand up together on issues with that are so important to another one of us, to another of us, then what good is it? Just to sit here and talk about it and not do something about it? What is that? You know what then? We're going to be frustrated till the end of time. And it's going to mean nothing. It means nothing. And this is a beautiful opportunity here. And you're doing it for all of us. You're not just doing it for yourself, this fight you've taken on. You're doing it for all of us. And I can't thank you enough. And that's why I will keep calling. And I will do whatever I can in any way to help you.
I appreciate it, Renee Louise. And there are manifestations of an appreciation for the passion you bring to this.
Thanks. Because I thank you. Because I hope I'm not pestering you. But it just means such a great deal that we don't reach out to each other enough. We don't take the time to look into each other's eyes enough. Not nearly enough. And that's why we are where we are. It's not God or some other cloud being that perhaps you want to believe, and that's fine if you believe in it. Call it whatever you want. But it is us who creates our reality. It lies within that mirror. When you look in there, it's you who create your own reality, how you perceive what's going on with you and what you do with it. In an individual basis, and then when we come together on a collective basis, it's the same thing. We are creating it. Mother Nature is screaming at us, look what you're doing to me. Is this how I have to react for you to get your attention? And look, we still are rubbing the sleep slowly out of our eyes, trying to decide, oh, am I just going to roll over and go to sleep? Or am I going to finally wake up? And here, right here, this little movement that we're trying to go, just to stand up and support Bob and everybody else involved in this call thing who's fighting for us. Right here, we can do a wake-up moment and then keep going.
Renee Louise, I don't want to intrude too, and because you know how I am about this, I don't want to intrude on your personal space or on anything that is private, but let me confirm something. You're not calling from the coal fields, are you?
Oh, no. No. No, I'm out in California right now. I'm way out in California, but I am so connected. You know, my mom has left this human world, but she's certainly present. One of the greatest things she did with me and the groundwork of this earth that we shared together was she threw me into a motorhome every summer. She was a teacher, math and science, and off we'd go. And we traveled every inch of this land. And even before I did that, well, actually, she had me traveling in her stomach when I was even born. Nova Scotia was the first place she brought me. And even before I can't even remember the first time, I've always been so connected to this earth. I've known that the land I walk on is a piece of me. I know the air that I breathe. I know the birds that I share this world with. So every single particle is a piece of me. And my mom throwing me in that motorhome was the greatest gift she could have ever done, because nature is my best friend. Because nature also showed me, it's the greatest book. There's a beautiful quote. I actually posted it on one of the forums in response to a post that David Fermain had said a reply, and I posted a reply back to him, and I ended it with a quote, and I'm completely paraphrasing it. So Native American, another people who I have had a connection with without having any no reasoning, quote unquote, for. But he said how he had gone to the white man's schools and he'd read the Bible and he read all the books. But he said there's a grander university, and he said it's the great mystery university, and that's nature. And he said you can take all of your books and you can lay them out in the sun and let the rain and the insects and the weather work on them for a while, and they'll become nothing. But nature's university is forever. And what you can learn from it is volumes. And nature taught me how we are all one. The preciousness of that, the preciousness of this human experience. For me to be able to feel my oneness with everyone, the oneness with the earth, my oneness with each one of you, when I look into somebody's eyes and I connect with them. That's the gift that we are all truly looking for. instead of trying to fill it with all this material crap that's around us, excuse the word, which means nothing, trying to fill that void, if we just reached out to each other, that void would be filled, whether you are cognizant of that void or not. It would be filled. We would be satisfied. You need very little in this world to be satisfied, to be happy. There's nothing like getting a hug from somebody. There's nothing like thinking of somebody who you hold in your heart, even those who haven't even met before. It's funny, somebody who just came to my mind right now, who I just recently met through a horn, is Gail. Now, out there in Australia.
Profound, profound, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? And those are the things. I'm very solitary right now in my, with who I have around me. And, you know, it's fine. It's on my own. I'm, you know, it, but yet, when I think of somebody like Gail comes to me like that, or you come to me, I get such strength from knowing that you guys are here in this world with me.
There you go. Yeah.
And that is everything. That keeps me. When, yesterday, I had a reality chaos from, I didn't get to hear this. It was just ridiculous. And I just stopped and I breathed. That's another thing we all need to do. That's another thing nature should taught me or reminded me of, because I don't really think we have to be taught anything. I think we've just forgotten it all with all this material stuff around us. Because if you listen to your heart, if you quiet the chatter of the world and your mind down, and respect yourself enough to do that daily, when you feel that energy going through you and you know you need it, if you do it, it is amazing how you can be guided. The truth, your truth that you can find. And yesterday I stopped and I just breathed. And you came to me. And this issue came to me. Gail came to me. A couple other people that you haven't actually met came to me. And I just knew, okay, it's okay.
Gonna get through this.
It's okay. Yeah, the world could fall down around us all right now. You know what? Then what I'm looking at right now really doesn't matter. You know? So I just took a deep breath and I said, you know, you've gotten this far. Take a deep breath. You're going to have to deal with it anyway. Take care of it. And I did. As soon as you cut it all off and you stop and you go, take care of it. And you do it, it falls right into, it was amazing how everything just fell into place. And I just stopped. I just stopped and I said, okay. And it was amazing how many people that I had available to call to help me. I couldn't even believe it. And how I was looking for, at one point I was looking for jumper cables. And the way these jumper cables came through four different other people was just amazing. I didn't even realize the connections that I had built just by walking my neighborhood.
Wow.
And what it meant for people to see me and my little dog walking through the neighborhood. And again, it's like the things that we think are our worst nightmares. My mom's passing was my worst nightmare and my greatest gift at the same time. Because it's brought me to truly so firmly walk my own truth, and also to follow the path that I knew I was meant to.
She raised you well.
Oh, she was beautiful. I'm very lucky to have had her as a guardian. And I can also say, too, I can share this as well. I don't mind putting it out there because I think it's what I'm saying as well. My dad, I haven't seen him in the longest time, but from day one that I've known him, he was an alcoholic. But I always knew, even during the really tumultuous times, I always knew how much my dad loved me. And that has been key. Sometimes it's made it harder, more difficult.
I can see where it would.
But the fact that I knew how much he loved me meant so much. And that's just what I guess I'm looking for here, for people to step up and send you a quick email and say, Bob, I'm with you. Because when we just love each other.
Well, you know, I've been at this long enough, Renee Louise, that I can see some sort of watermarks of the impact that things have. For instance, you know from having been in the chat room that it can, that, you know, the screen can just fly by.
Oh, yeah.
But I've also learned enough to know that when someone is speaking who has the whole attention of the people who are listening, for instance, in the chat room, the screen comes to a dead stop.
Yeah.
With the exception of a brief post, there has just now been an 8-minute silence in the room as people listen to your words. So know that you are having an impact. Know that your words mean something. Know that the ideas that you present are freighted with a goodness that can be life-changing, and an affirmation of the little things that can make life hyper-real in a world, as you noted, where we seek out meaning and reality in things that cannot convey it to us, but still we persist. Those little moments of reality are the ones that you hang on to all the way to the end of this ride.
And what you just gave to me, and that's just it too, when you give of yourself, of who you truly are, it's amazing what you get back, because what you just gave me, and I have to thank everybody who is listening to what I'm putting out there, what I'm offering, what's coming through me, whatever, because you've just given me what this moment has just given, the strength it's given me to carry on with what I'm talking, because what I'm talking about is my walk in life, is what I'm looking to put forth in life. And the fact that somebody can find something in it too, even if it were one person, that's...
Oh, I think, yeah, it all connects, Renee Louise. I think back to our Monday night conversation with Scott in Salem, Massachusetts, and the project that he's working on now.
Right.
And you know, what is the title that he made for that? He's calling it "Make the Path."
Yeah.
And you talk about, you know, the path that you walk. There's a connectivity here that we are leveraging by virtue of some pretty intense technology, but the connectivity that we are that we are fostering goes far beyond anything contemplated in the mind of man, humankind.
Exactly. It's so much more valuable. It is what we are. It is our that essential element of us. That innate, intrinsic factor that we all carry within us, that we all share, it's beyond even the capacity of our imagination, our minds, yet we know the feeling. We know the consciousness of it. And that's what it's about. And that comes when we give ourselves and we love others as fully as we can, and as honestly and genuinely as we can. And knowing when to stop getting caught up in this material world around us, and to have the balance of our consciousness and the material, our humanness, to balance those two, there's nothing like it. It's magic. When you balance them, the magic that transpires is unbelievable. And I feel it happening. This is one of the moments where it's occurring. And again, I can't say thank you enough to everybody who I can feel listening, and to you on the other end of the phone there. And that's just it. It's nothing about the material. It's so much deeper. It's so much more poignant. There's no human word for me to put to it. It's bliss. Is the closest I can come to it. And it's what life truly is about. As I've said, and I've said it before, and I've posted it, it's what is the ultimate value of a being's life, or of all life. And there it is. It's what we're sharing right now. And I can't, it's love. And I can't say enough to everyone out there what it means to me that we're stopping and we're listening together, and we're sharing of ourselves fully together. Because you don't have to be talking to share yourself fully with someone. One of the the things I look for in a friend. The best kind of friend is that friend you can be sitting on the porch with, swinging on the swing for hours with, not say a word. And you both get up and you walk different directions, and you've had the best conversation you've ever had.
I know.
And that's what we're having here right now. Yeah, there's some talking going on, but there's even more going on that's not unspoken. And I just say thank you to everybody. And I hope those emails come rolling in.
They are. And we will pursue this, Renee Louise. We will.
Well, I'm going to keep calling in, too.
Okay, that's fine.
To follow up.
That's absolutely all right.
All you have to do is, it doesn't even have to be long. You can just say.
No, that's what it's coming in. You know, I'm there.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Bob.
Oh, no trouble at all, Renee Louise. Thank you. Thank you very kindly.
And thanks, everybody. Everybody. Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. There is little to be said beyond what Renee Louise has offered. I wish I could come to it, have it to hand as quickly as I would like. There's everything that she was referencing is contained in a line at the beginning of Tom Robbins' Still Life with Woodpecker about be patient, don't even be patient, sit still, don't even be still, sit and wait. I can't remember what it is. Somebody will send me the link in a minute. But it's a lot of what she was talking about, and it's something that has impressed me for a very, very, very long time. I want to share something with you real quick, because Renee Louise did bring the topic up. This is well worth the time to read it and to hear it. I don't usually read lengthy pieces on the air, because I think part of the reading experience is the voice that you hear in your own head. And I always fear, frankly, boring you. But this isn't boring. This is reality in the extreme. And this touches on the topic that Renee Louise was addressing. It's over at Alternet. It is a letter. It is a letter by a person that I'm proud to call friend, Bo Webb. He lives down in the Coal River Valley. It is a letter addressed to the President of the United States, and it is as follows. Dear Mr. President, as I write this letter, I brace myself for another round of nerve-wracking explosives being detonated above my home in the mountains of West Virginia. Outside my door, pulverized rock dust laden with diesel fuel and ammonium nitrate explosives hovers in the air, along with the residual of heavy metals that once lay dormant underground. The mountain above me, once a thriving forest, has been blasted into a pile of rock and mud rubble. 2 years ago, it was covered with rich black topsoil and abounded with hardwood trees, rhododendrons, ferns, and flowers. The understory thrived with herbs like ginseng, black cohosh, yellow root, and many other medicinal plants. Black bears, deer, wild turkey, hawks, owls, and thousands of birds lived here. The mountain contained sparkling streams teeming with aquatic life. Now it's all gone. It's all dead. I live at the bottom of a mountaintop removal coal mining operation in the Peachtree community. President Obama, I'm writing you because we have simply run out of options. Last week, the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court in Richmond, Virginia, overturned a federal court ruling for greater environmental restrictions on mountaintop removal permits. Dozens of permits now stand to be rushed through. As you know, last December, the Environmental Protection Agency under George W. Bush allowed an 11th-hour change to the stream buffer zone rule, further unleashing the coal companies to do as they please. During your presidential campaign, you declared, quote, we have to find more environmentally sound ways of mining coal than simply blowing the tops off mountains, unquote. That time is now. Or never. Every day, more than 3 million pounds of explosives are detonated in our state to remove our mountains and expose the thin seams of coal. Over 470 mountains in Appalachia have been destroyed in this process. The coal scooped up and hauled away to be burned at coal-fired power plants across our country and abroad. This includes the Potomac River plant, which generates the electricity for the White House. Mountaintop removal is the dirty secret in our nation's energy supply. If coal can't be mined clean, it can't be called clean. Here, at the point of extraction, coal passes through a preparation plant that manages to remove some, but not all, of the metals and toxins. Those separated impurities are stored in mammoth toxic sludge dams above our communities throughout Appalachia. There are three sludge dams within 10 miles of my home. Coal companies are now blasting directly above and next to a dam above my home that contains over 2 billion gallons of toxic waste. That is the same seeping dam that hovers just 400 yards above the Marsh Fork Elementary School. As you know, coal sludge dams have failed before, and lives have been lost. My family and I, like many American citizens in Appalachia, are living in a state of terror. Like sitting ducks waiting to be buried in an avalanche of mountain waste or crushed by a falling boulder, we are trapped in a war zone within our own country. In 1968, I served my country in Vietnam as part of the 1st Battalion, 12th Marines, 3rd Marine Division. As you know, Appalachians have never failed to serve our country. Our mountain riflemen stood with George Washington at the surrender of the British in Yorktown. West Virginia provided more per capita soldiers for the Union during the Civil War than any other state. We have given our blood for every war since. We have also given our blood for the burden of coal in these mountains. My uncle died in the underground mines at the age of 17. Another uncle was paralyzed from an accident. My dad worked in an underground mine. Many in my family have suffered from black lung disease. These mountains are our home. My family roots are deep in these mountains. We homesteaded this area in the 1820s. This is where I was born. This is where I will die. On January 15, 1972, U.S. Senator John D. Rockefeller made a speech at Morris Harvey College. He declared, quote, "The government has turned its back on the many West Virginians who have borne out of their property and out of their pocketbook the destructive impact of strip mining. We hear that the governor once claimed to have wept as he flew over the strip mine devastation of our state. Now it's the people who weep." Our state government has turned its back on us in 2009. Peachtree is but one of hundreds of Appalachian communities that are being bombed. Our property has been devalued to worthlessness. Our neighbors, fellow American citizens, put their kids to bed at night with the fear of being crushed or swept away in toxic sludge. And the outside coal industries continue their criminal activity through misleading and false ads. Mr. President, when I heard you talk during your campaign stops, it made me feel like there was hope for Peachtree and the Coal River Valley of West Virginia. Hope for me and my family. Abraham Lincoln wrote that we cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. I beg you to relight our flame of hope and honor and immediately stop the coal companies from blasting so near our homes and endangering our lives. As you have said, we must find another way than blowing off the tops of our mountains. We must end mountaintop removal. I ask you to please put an end to these dangerous, toxic sludge dams with utmost respect. Yours truly, Bo Webb. I know where Bo lives. I know the absolute truth of every word that he wrote. I don't know how long ago this was posted at Alternet, alternet.org. It was posted today, I know that. The title, American Citizens in Appalachia Are Living in a State of Terror. I received an email from our good friend Jeff Biggers, the author of The United States of Appalachia. And a mighty voice in this struggle. I'd say I received it within the hour. And I go to Alternet quite frequently. There's a lot of good information there. I was there the other day and happened upon some story about sexuality. That thing had comments threaded and sub-threaded and sub-sub-threaded on and on and on. I mean, it seemed endless. There is one comment to Bo Webb's letter. One. I find that a little stunning. Or wish it wasn't. But that is the world in which we operate. That is the little universe of how it is. So it's about 25 minutes past the third hour of this program, 25 minutes past 8 p.m. here on the East Coast. And I can tell you that the coal companies and their acolytes and their minions are jumping for joy. They are filled with a destroyer's glee at the decision that came out this past Friday. Workers who are daily terrorized by their employers with the threat that the environmentalists are after your jobs are happier than pigs in slop because they think this means the money will keep coming at the same time that coal companies are laying off all over the country because of the economic decline that has hit them. But it is the environmentalists whom they have been told are their enemies. The same crowd that talks about how we can't do anything in America anymore, the Cantniks of the Republican Party and the bought-off politicians of the Democratic Party in this state, the ones who, at the mere mention of jobs, will leap and holler and stand aside for whatever destruction anyone cares to wreak on this region, are all cut from the same cloth. They are people who have no vision. People blinded by coal dust, or blinded by money, or blinded by greed, or blinded by fear, they are blind. There's a story in the news today about the woman from Iran who had acid thrown on her and was blinded by an attacker who was attacking her because he loved her. She has demanded, within the tenets of law as expressed in that country, that her convicted attacker be punished by having acid dripped into his eyes, that she literally be granted an eye for an eye. And I'm reminded of that line attributed, I believe, to Gandhi, that an eye for an eye and the world goes blind. We deal with the same sort of thing in this country. We have no vision. We are blinded by the thugs, con artists, and cut purses on Wall Street. We are blinded by the confidence men in the energy industry, be it coal, oil, or gas. We are blinded by the economic hitmen who have wrecked and racked this nation in their insufferable, insatiable drive for more, 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 gimme, gimme, gimme. We have been assaulted by people for whom the very notion of learning a foreign language is somehow threatening. We have been put under the gun of terror and fear by people who think that a separate group of human beings, an ethnic group, not a race, but an ethnic group, there is no such thing as race. But people who think that an ethnic group speaks a language named after their religion, who thinks that mothers cuddling their infants sing lullabies to them in Islamic. This is not the blind leading the blind. This is more a case of the blind trying to put out the eyes of the sighted. Of the resentment of those who willfully will not see, of those who still have a desire to see far beyond the ends of their own noses. That is the challenge that we face. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. We'll be back.
Somebody shouts out. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Twenty-one minutes before the hour, and we return to wrap the program up for the evening. Let's go straight to the phones. Alan joins us. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. I wasn't listening to the news this week. I had other things in my mind. And then I had a right-winger relative say to me that something about Obama said it about President Obama sending a sculpture of Winston Churchill back to England. It just has hurt their feelings and it's making people mad. So,
What?
Have you heard about that?
I usually think I'm pretty well plugged in, Alan, but that one plumb evades me.
It was a bust of Winston Churchill that was in his office. And it was on loan to George Bush, and then the British said that he could keep him there. But instead, Obama said that, you know, send it back because he didn't want to look at it every day. And so I did some research into it, and I found on the Huffington Post that Obama's great-grandfather was tortured by the British under the command of Winston Churchill, so I don't blame him for sending it back.
Well,
if I got the story correct.
Live and learn. You know, Churchill is routinely held up as a great man. And
I know
there were elements of him that were great, but there were many elements that were not. You know, he is, for all intents and purposes, Winston Churchill is the birth father of every last little problem that we have with Iran. Just as a for instance, there's no getting around it. He was the one who implored Harry Truman to help the British depose the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, a man by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh, and Truman said no. But once Eisenhower got into office in 1953, Churchill prevailed upon him. Eisenhower said yes. Mossadegh was deposed. The Shah was returned to the peacock throne. And every last problem we have with that country flows from that moment of ugly imperial fascist-flavored thuggery.
I didn't know that. I know Churchill was pretty cruel to the Indians, Indians.
Oh, he was, well, he was downright rude to Mohandas K. Gandhi.
Yeah. He's also like a bipolar depression type guy, so he wasn't always mentally stable either.
Yeah, he referred to his depressive bouts as the black dog.
Uh-huh.
And also, you know, a lot of booze, a lot of cigars, a lot of hard living. Yeah, this is not to say that he did not have about him an element of greatness, but it is by no means it is by no means not subject to to question.
Yeah, and even President Roosevelt, I imagine you could find things about him that he wasn't such a perfect guy after all, but he did a lot of great things, and so did Churchill. But if he tortured my great granddaddy, I wouldn't want to look at his sculpture every day either.
No, and frankly, it's it was on loan, so thank you very much. Here, you can have it back now. Enjoy it somewhere. Because one of the things, and I don't blame Obama on this front either, because it was that sculpture, if I recall correctly, Alan, that led people like Peggy Nooner, led her to write things comparing George Bush to Churchill. And, you know, that's just odious. It's just wrong. It's historically insane. So, you know.
I just wondered if the right-wing media points that out, that Obama's great-grandfather was tortured by the British. But I imagine they don't point that part of the story out.
Well, you know, in light of the fact that what became Kenya was a British possession, if I recall correctly, it's entirely likely that more than Obama's grandfather was probably tortured. The British had a very, very heavy-handed way of dealing with their subject possessions, whether it be slaughters and massacres in India or, you know, they pulled the same trick on both India and Ireland. Gunning down innocents, I think in both instances on a soccer field. Or
same thing in our revolution.
Sure.
Same thing in our Revolutionary War.
Exactly. I had no idea that. But you see, that's where the Repig-Lickin' Party is now, Alan. They don't have any issues. They're down to their members of Congress are down to voting against packages that will benefit the several states and then going home to their districts and pretending as if they had voted for them. They're down to having fits, you know, trying to gin up a little bit of phony outrage among their mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking right-wing religion industry faithful via claims that, you know, the homosexuals are going to eat your marriage license, or, well, the mountain removers saying, oh, liberty, even our environmentalists are going to get our jobs. They don't have anything. They don't have any issues. So, of course, they're down to manufacturing outrage over a bust of Winston Churchill.
Yeah, because they don't have anything else to talk about, and the only pork that they want is like a military contractor's something to do with war, and something that's just a one-way street, just takes up our tax dollars, and then that's it. It's just if we build a bridge or something, we got that for years to come, but not with their wasteful spending.
No, and not with the throwaways that they do either, Alan. The whole and see, this is one of the things that makes me think that Iraq was a lie. But it wasn't like, you know, they put forward, well, we didn't know we were lying. Of course they knew. Because beyond the imperial scope of the reasoning behind the assault on Iraq, it also represented an opportunity for the Repig-Lickin' Party, which above all despises the constitutional form of government which we have, It was an opportunity for them to try to once and for all break everything that they hate about the United States of America, from constitutional government to programs that look out for the well-being, that enable we the people to look out for the well-being of we the people. Everything. They wanted to destroy it. They had 8 years to try to do it in, and they came that close.
Yeah. You know, the comparison between, like, the Patriot Act and this recent bill that passed is that the Patriot Act, nobody read that. If they're saying that this stimulus bill, nobody read the stimulus bill, but the Republicans don't say anything about nobody read the Patriot Act.
Oh, no, and yet, oddly enough, if you ask, for instance, Democrats about the stimulus bill, they can, as Congressman Frank Pallone did with Mark Levin a little bit ago, they can cite chapter and verse of what things do. You know, we got a couple of hundred members of the House of Representatives, any one of which could well have been tasked with knowing what it meant to his or her home district. And yet all the Republicans have is to stand up and say, no, we can't. We're pitiful. We can't.
Well, that's a Democrat that was on Mark Levin's show.
Yeah, that
didn't sound like much of a... He didn't seem much like a fighter to me.
Well, he's been in the House of Representatives for 20 years, and as a consequence, he is one of those political pragmatists that Washington grows so well. You know, a little back slapping, a little handshaking. You know, probably not a bad guy, but one of these people who, I can't imagine being that way, but I can certainly see where Washington, D.C. would do that to you. So, you know, he's
a big party.
No, not a big party, but just, you know, let's get done what we can do. You know, no room for idealists. Let's not be running around dreaming big dreams. Let's just do the little things that we can accomplish.
Yeah, forget about what the people want.
Well, or for that matter, not being the people not being able to reach them with their voices. I mean, we live to a certain degree in a segment of the political world or a segment of the political union here on the Horn, for instance, Alan, and everybody here knows the vitality and the vital necessity of universal single-payer health care. We know the moral wrongness of companies out there profiting on the illness of human beings. We know that. It's not an article of faith. It's something we know. But yet, when you go to Congress, Alan, you got to take a lot of money from people that you would otherwise, if you saw them coming at you on the sidewalk, you'd cross the street to avoid them, because they're the ones who can get you in office, and they're also the ones who can keep you there. And once you have taken their token, you must use that token to take their ride.
Uh-huh. Well, I really admire the people who don't take money from these guys. I can think of two of them, Bernie Sanders and Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah. And there are others.
Yeah, they need to be
elevated, cherished, valued. Yeah, without a doubt, without a doubt. Well, Alan, it is time for me to wrap things up. Good talking to you. You back home now?
No, I'm headed to Muscle Shoals, your neck of the woods.
Are you really? Oh, my goodness.
To the TVA there.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, there's some good eating to be had up there. A little place called Cajun's has the best grilled oysters I have ever had in my life, right there near the O'Neill Bridge. Probably wouldn't be hard at all to find. Might be tough to get into with your truck, though.
Okay. Oh, no, I could get to anywhere with this van. I'm in a van now.
Oh, easy then.
Okay, what's the name of it again?
Cajun's. It's right on Highway 43 on the Colbert County side of the Tennessee River. Side of the, yeah.
Oh, I'll check it out.
Right, tasty. Grilled oysters, Cajun grilled oysters. Man, are they good.
All right.
So
I wish I could meet you there.
I wish I could too. Shoot me a picture and send it. If you order you some, shoot me a picture, shoot along, and I'll fire it over to the website. And then everybody can have their mouths watering.
All right.
All right, you take care, Alan. Drive careful now.
All right, you too.
And bye now.
Goodbye.
On the road, our buddy Alan the trucker and his traveling companion, Miss Lula, the standard poodle, who I think in his last phone call he said looks more like a bear right about now and is in need of a nice grooming. I got to find out the title of it, but we've got a new video up. ELO, Sue, our video production specialist, says that it is up on YouTube now. Let me see. And basically, it's a video built around that version of Take Me Home Country Roads that you heard on the program, I guess, Friday evening, as performed beautifully by Tanya Adkins. So I'm waiting here to see if this thing will pop up for me. I'm having some computer crankiness. I guess we're due for a restart or something, or Java doesn't like me anymore. Okay, the title of it is Country Roads Parody Video. Yeah, that's what the name of it is, Country Roads Parody Video. Oh, and the opening frames, and it is brilliant. Oh, man, Sue, you have outdone yourself. Yeah, I think that, share this, will you? Share this. This is brilliant. I'm telling you, and I'm not even listening. I'm not even listening to the music right now. You want to see this? I'm going to pass this around to the list we have, and people will be blown away by it. So I guess we've come to the end of our program this evening. Looking forward to another 3 hours tomorrow night with you as Friday dawns upon us. I had a couple of more stupid goes clean to the bone folks. Maybe we'll get to them tomorrow. And you know what? The other thing I didn't get to was a couple of signs of hope out there. And those are important. So remind me, and maybe we'll get started with that tomorrow. Because hope springs eternal. And frankly, while it may spring eternal, the spring sometimes seems to dwindle to a drip. And we need to hang on to those for dear life. I'll tell you a little secret. I hope I'm not going out on a limb with this, but John Fox is working on a new song parody that I think will blow your socks off. Maybe, God willing, we'll have that thing ready by tomorrow evening's program. We work on these things together, and I just told John I'm like a kid on Christmas, 6 years old. Oh, I want to see it. I want to hear it. I want to hear it. Come on. These things take time, though. John Fox is a master of his craft. And then, if Sue gets hold of it and turns it into a video, look out. I think this is going to be fun. Thank you to everyone who emailed in at Renee Louise's request this evening. If you're hearing this later on, don't hesitate to go ahead and email. I'm pulling them all into one place, and when we get this thing put together, I will notify all of you, and you can sign on. Of course, the easiest way to do that is also just to keep an eye on headonradionetwork.com and headonradionetwork.com/forum, and it'll go up there as well. Many thanks to John Fox, who does so many brilliant things in so many different fields of endeavor. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. Thanks to the most overworked man in liberal talk, Ben Birch. WhiteRoseSociety.org. No White Rose Society, no horn. It's that simple. Ben never sends a bill. Thank you to all of you who financially contribute to keeping the horn on the air. These are tough times. I know how tough they are. And for those of you who are able to make that sacrifice, it is appreciated in ways that almost go beyond expression. We have a contribution button at headonradionetwork.com. And we also have a snail mail address for those of you who prefer not to use PayPal. That is Head On 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB318, Beckley, BECKLEY, West Virginia, 25801. Thank you to our friends, our heroes at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Just the things that I share with you along the way perhaps give you an idea of the dedication and the hard work that go in to every single day of Coal River Mountain Watch's world. CRMW.net, ColeRiverWind.org. Fighting upstream for all who are downstream. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The situation is dire in America. It just doesn't seem to get any worse. Trying to live with, the Bush Great Depression. We have Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, coming yesterday and saying that he doesn't think we're going to be out of recession until 2011. He served a rise of 80%. The car industry is falling apart. Obama, I think, very wisely decided not to have a car czar, the great last Bush idea on this. Foreclosures are up. President Obama did have a very interesting proposal to help Americans who are on the verge of foreclosure that he announced yesterday, and we'll want to talk about that during this hour. State budgets, well, they're in trouble too. See, states don't have the ability, the way the federal government does, to borrow money. They've got to, most of the time, basically just have a balanced budget. So with the decline in housing prices, the decline in property taxes, the decline in income taxes in general, because of all the Americans that are unemployed, well, states are cutting services. More than 40 out of 50 states are cutting services and payroll. 28 are cutting public health, at least. 22 at least are cutting aid to the elderly and the disabled. It just doesn't seem to give us any good news. But the only good news we have thus far is the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress signing on to a stimulus package that's supposed to help us get out of our Great Depression. And I want to talk about the stimulus package today with my guest. He is Chairman Frank Pallone, Congressman of New Jersey. He is the chairman of the Health Subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Now, what that means is that Congressman Pallone is in charge of a lot of those very, very important health things that, well, you may not know who funds them, things like the NIH, National Institute of Health, that goes out and tries to find cures for cancer, or the Center for Disease Control that does such an amazing job to try to prevent AIDS and other contagious diseases. And what's interesting is that there's a lot of things hidden in the stimulus package that really go a long way toward public health. One of the things that the Republicans were complaining about was that the Democrats were sneaking some of their agenda in the stimulus package. And they thought it was a bad thing. But actually, I think it's quite a good thing, a lot of the things that they've put in, things like having your health care on computers, your health information, so that if you go to a new doctor and you don't remember what your doctor said 5 years ago, a lot of doctors, frankly, charge you to get your own files from that doctor. And so, you have files, you move, and then there's another doctor's file, and most people don't pay to get all their files together. The idea of putting it all on one place, you got to have protections for security, of course. But the idea of putting all of healthcare in one place so that people can go from doctors to doctor and actually have healthcare. Well, that is another provision in this bill. So I'm told now that Congressman Frank Pallone has joined us. Congressman Pallone, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks a lot. Good to be on the show.
Well, let me start with some of the health care provisions in the stimulus package, because I know
Sure.
you worked very hard on them, and frankly, they haven't gotten a lot of attention. Tell us what was in the stimulus package relating to health care.
Well, there were